Welcome to episode 166 of Muse on Minis.
Musing and amusing.
This is Keith.
Wait, what? When did we switch it?
It happens organically, Josh. These things just...
No, it doesn't sit right with me.
Actually, last time is when we switched it. You weren't...
When I wasn't here? Look, I demand more respect as a regular member of this podcast.
In order to be a regular member of the podcast, show up to podcast.
Well, look, there's been 3 weeks in which I've been a quote-unquote regular member of this podcast, and I've been here two.
Right.
That's just as good as Crump.
33. No, I'm pretty sure with the 160 episodes that he did, I bet he made a higher percentage.
If you're talking
about as much respect as Crump.
Muse regulars, yeah. You're talking about Chad, because it's Keith and John and the other regulars.
And the other guys.
<That's right.
laughs>
The other guys.
The other guys. Yeah.
That's got to sit really good.
I love that.
I mean,
bit,
you already made the joke I was going to make, which is you probably get as much respect as Crump.
As Crump, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm not sure he's got to that point yet.
I am not the best statistical mercenary player in the country like Crump is. So.
Or the most entertaining member on the cast.
So, Mise en Minis, episode 166. Here we are. This is Keith.
Oh, I guess this is Josh.
Oh, and I play Crix and stuff.
And I play Pirates and stuff. Yar.
This is Chad, and I play Trolls. And no stuff.
Good.
Yeah. And this is John, and I play Convergence of Cirrus.
And this is Nigel, and
it
I play
Connor. Literally doesn't matter what you say.
I never have time to play games. It's bad.
John, and I play Bridge.
This is John, and I am aware of the rules of War Machine.
So, I have an idea. I think I'm going to make a token that says you've been ducked by...
People are requesting... Guy wanted you to make print shirts that say, I've been ducked by John Damaris, and then like on the back is like some kind of like duck tour or something like that.
No, I'm literally just going to make a token with a duck on it.
Yeah, that'll work.
Wanted Colin to work on like a Duck McQuack caster for whatever faction, like Menoth, and then we could basically make like the art and everything, but it would be essentially like a duck version of John. With like a token of just him.
Would it have the horrifically racist buck teeth that Iris had?
We don't have to play that card.
Yeah. Just curious.
John's got a lot of qualities we can make fun of. We don't have to play the
race
card. That's
100%.
The race card.
All right, so some news and announcements. Vengeance has been released, and since everything in that book we've been aware of already, that's about all we'll say about it.
Yeah, it was pretty much the most exciting release of my life.
I don't know if it's because the books have gotten smaller or just because they've decided to manage things differently, but yes, there were no surprises left.
Is this the first time that a book was completely 100% spoiled?
Yes.
I think so, too.
I'm willing to bet that they don't do that again. And I really think it was a timing thing, because it seems like Vengeance, I feel like, got delayed.
I don't know.
It feels like it did.
It felt like it was a long time between. Yeah.
It felt like some parts of it got accelerated. Like they really wanted to get Butcher out for that 10th anniversary thing.
Yeah.
And then they just kept things coming.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but yeah, the book needs to come out at some point.
Yeah, rolling the Kickstarter guys into it and everything else is just sort of...
If the Kickstarter things had been unknown, this would have been a very exciting time.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how the Colossals release was.
Well, Colossals release was so small.
Yeah, we didn't know much.
Yeah.
We knew very little.
A quick question on sort of all of us as like our player psychologies. Do any of us feel like our faction's complete? Like, when a new book comes out? Like, so, when I got Vengeance, I, like, flipped through the pages furiously, and then immediately got super depressed. It was like a, you know, premature, whatever.
Like, you didn't get what you wanted.
Asian. What's that?
Like, you didn't get what you wanted, basically.
Correct. It was like, there was just nothing there to be excited about. But, like, you know, I don't know if a Crix player feels the same way. Like, if you're just like, I have no holes.
I guess I kind of do. There are points in time when I'm like, I don't know what they'll come out for with Crix to excite me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just... There's nothing that I'm holding out hope. Like, I just need... Like, if I just had this, I can make a whole new kind of list that's never been seen before.
Yeah.
No, I don't think I have anything like that.
I just think it's for, like, a Crix player, it's been a pretty boring, what, 4 years?
Since...
Two.
The last... Yeah, two, I would say. The last time anything truly exciting happened was pretty close to, It was like when the first book in Mark II, after the faction books came out.
Is Iacos like the best thing that Crix has gotten in
Mark II? Iacos is the best thing in ages. The Scarlock Commander is more exciting than I initially gave him credit for.
Colin Hill was raving about him at Mayhem Cup.
Yeah, and Will
that
was getting
not stupid.
Will was getting a lot of work out of them too, like charge because they have Battle Wizard apparently, and some other stuff. So they were like getting a lot of kills
with the Scarlock
with
commander?
The commander itself because it would like charge and then Hellfire and then generated souls and did some work and increased the command range.
It's a pretty good 1-point solo.
The way Colin was describing it to me is it's just like he's like it's another Biothrall that doesn't have crap stats and has 5 HP. So like normally like a blast template drifts down a Biothrall and you're like, sweet, it's dead. It's another Biothrall I don't have to worry about. Like a blast template drifts down like the Scarlock Commander and you actually have to roll like lights out to kill it. Like,
it doesn't purge.
It does when an Excarnate guy appears 8 inches in front of it.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the Scarlock Commander is more exciting than I initially gave it credit for, but it's not something revolutionary.
Well, it's only one point.
It's a one-point model.
It's a one-point model.
So that's the weird thing. Like, it's really hard to weigh how good a one-point model is because...
And I think they'd have to do something pretty unexpected in the Warjack department. Like, the Warjack department is really the only place in Crix I feel there is room for true exciting growth.
I really like the new Seether Chassis Warjack. It's 8 points. At 8 points, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah. Did we originally have it at 9?
We did. That's what we guessed it at, but it's 8.
It's so 8.
That's really good.
8's a bit more exciting.
Yeah. It's a really good jack for 8 points.
Yeah. And I think all the new jacks are 8, actually.
I believe so.
I thought the Grolar was 9. I'm pretty sure the Grolar is 9.
The Grolar is probably 9 because Cotter's got to pay a tax for that sweet Cortex.
Yep. Like, yeah, if you approve the Kodiak at all, it's going to be. It's going to have to go up in points.
You gave it a gun? Dun, dun, dun. 12-point model.
So to answer your question for trolls, at least, Nigel, and I don't know if that is within the purview of what you're wanting to know since this is sort
of
a war
machine
release.
Well, with hordes, I think it's, you can assume the answer. It's kind of interesting because you're going to get a different experience because a lot of it isn't spoiled yet. At least I hope not. But, I mean, hordes, everybody's, like, all of them feel like they have huge holes that they want filled in.
But I just wanted to say, like, I have felt, like, in the last couple of books, like, that there have been, like, a little bit. Like, there's been different. It's been feeling, like, different scope for the last couple of books. Domination, I feel like we didn't get as much. Like, they kind of gave us the character unit, and they gave us some light war beasts that changed our game a little bit and, like, filled in a little bit of a hole. Like, the Storm Troll got, you know, it started to see a little bit of play, like, a couple of years after it was released. But, like, nothing else.
You've
really
got to be getting kind of confused, too, by, what is it, Night Troll plus Highwayman? You're like, so more range units and then a beast that...
The Night Troll's already out.
It's already, yeah, he's in less, but yeah. I was like, anyways, their releases have been weird.
Yeah. No, but it's more, like, Sluggers were the...
Yep.
But that was at the very beginning of Mark II. But, I mean, just this very last book, like, I felt like, you know, one of our big holes is Crix and upkeeps, and we got the Sorcerer. And even though it hasn't seen a lot of play yet, it hasn't been out. But I haven't made that many lists that really capitalize on it. And it only really fixes the problem for units, but it's still, like, at least it felt good to have that small gap.
It's
like,
it's another bullet in the holster, which is good.
Yeah.
One thing that I've noticed just looking at the announcements for Exigence, I feel like that book is innovative. I don't feel like Vengeance had any innovative mechanics, but I see things in Exigence, I'm like, ooh, that's really cool. Units that generate fury, really cool.
Yeah,
because it addresses an issue in hordes where you a lot of times have to be somewhat beast heavy to ensure fury generation for your warlock throughout the entire game.
It's interesting, but in the last few cycles, they've been innovating on the Hordes releases and then following up that innovation on the War Machine side.
Well, and I feel like Convergence of Cirrus is actually very innovative.
That's true.
And here's my theory. And you guys, I love DC. And DC a long time ago told me that this Hordes book that was coming up, it was like, he's like, not the next Hordes book, but the one after that is the one that I sort of have had more direction in. I'm excited to see what people think about that. So what I'm excited for is the next War Machine book after this Hordes book.
Hmm.
Because I wonder if there'll be more innovation there. Because I think you saw with Convergence, you know, DC did everything in conversions. Like, that was his baby. Very innovative, making the focus mechanic work without breaking the game. Like, I think conversions is certainly strong, but I don't think it in any way breaks the game. But it's really neat. Like, you can play a bunch of Warjacks, and it's really cool. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely room. I don't think the game has gone stale, if that's...
No, not at all.
The
I
implication.
Mean, yeah.
But I do as a Crix player, I agree that I was more interested, like, in the Signar section of the book than I was in the Crix. Because I was just like, I know that they would have to do, like, that it would be something that leapt out of the page and slapped me in the face if it was something that was going to change Crix. Whereas for Signar, there are some more subtle things that I'd be really interested in.
This is actually something, like, as a mercenary player, I think it's kind of an advantage of being a mercenary player. And I actually think at this point, like, the faction, playing it as a faction, like, you have an answer to do, like, whatever you want with Galleon and Earthbreaker. Like, the only thing that would be nice is to have a jack or two that could answer armor issues without being a colossal. But that's, like whatever problem you have, like, mercenaries has an answer for it. The cool thing about being a mercenary player is every time a book comes out, like, you could literally get, like, a unit or a solo that just does something, like, crazy and off the wall. Like, every time, like, if there's going to be, like, some kind of, like, interesting rule variant, some cool little innovation or whatever, like, it's going to, like, frequently show up in mercenaries. And it's just kind of cool to wait and see what you get for that, which I think is why having it all spoiled ahead of time was kind of disappointing. But I have, obviously, the Cephalix to look forward to. So,
well, and I also think it's very different depending on where you are in sort of your career. So a lot of us are veterans and have been playing War Machine for a very long time.
True.
So something to shake up our primary factions, it would have to be extremely innovative, extremely new, or extremely against the design decisions in that have been made during, you know, throughout the course of the game. So, for example, you'd have to have a counter check that was incredibly focus efficient, like, you know, high mat, high rat, you know, something that was completely different for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be really exciting for you, but it would also have to break sort of the rules that they've established in the canon for Kador. And I don't think they're going to do that. It'd be the same thing as me getting, like, access to Pathfinder for my Jax and Protectorate.
Yeah, I think with, for instance, my Kador needs, it's always, like, access to some of those utility parts, like stealth, stealth mitigation, magic weapons, you know,
set on, removal.
Yeah, exactly, that type of stuff.
So do you laugh at the Retribution players then?
Oh, yeah, I'm jealous. I mean, I'm hyper jealous. I mean, like, right when that community was about to get as insufferable on forums as possible, they got everything they wanted.
Yeah.
Hey, squeaky wheel gets the oil, man. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. Kator hasn't, like, that's this thing that Nate's talked to me about. He feels like they've been stagnating ever since Mark 1. Mm-hmm. And that, like, pretty much the only release that has even changed the faction a little bit, and it's not even that it's changed it, it's just given them sort of a fresh perspective, is Butch 3.
I would almost argue that War Machine has just sort of been that way. Like, just those four, the big four. That's just sort of...
I could see that.
Because Signar hasn't really changed that much. They still have gun... They're gun mage based with mercs, you know?
No, I don't know. I've seen a lot of innovation happen.
Actually, Stormwall changed them huge.
Yeah.
That, like, that blew them wide open, but...
But, I mean, Protectorate Gunlines didn't really exist. And that sort of came to be, and they've sort of passed now, I think. Because
there's been more... There's been a lot more work in Protectorate switching back and forth. And I think it's because they have both very strong troop and warjack options.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a little crazy in your Protectorate builds, and without going into the realm of this just isn't going to work. That's harder to do in Signar. Not impossible. There are some heavier warjack builds that I think are not bad. Whether or not they're good enough is another question.
I really like the Pihaly list that we built. Mm-hmm. It was very warjack heavy.
So there's some options there, but then a lot of the, like, both Crix and Kador are more in a position where the number of warjacks that is permissible is closer to a defined number rather than a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
And that's not to say there aren't the rare exception, like the Morten Eber list that Tom Guan has been using is effective. He's proven that. But that's... It's kind of one list.
It's the exception that proves the rule.
I might argue that. Because I know I find, like, I'm just like, Phil, like, get my arc nodes in and then forget about it. Or one arc node in Death Jack and then forget about it.
When's the last time we saw more than two Jacks in a Kator list?
Ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Like, usually it's just one.
Usually it is just one. But, like, there's, I can't think of times where I have seen two. I can never think of a time where I saw more than three that wasn't, like... I mean, I can think of really gimmicky,
a very
like,
bad list.
Karchev lists that I didn't think did well or, you know, whatever.
So, yeah, that's... And that's really, I feel, where the factions have room to expand. Because there's nothing that says that they couldn't make a play style where Kador could play their Warjacks viable with the right support pieces and still keep it in theme. Same goes for Krix. It just requires something very different than what we're seeing now.
Kator Choir.
Like, Will, actually, with his Gorshade list, has created something close to that. I'm not 100% sold, but he's been having some success with it. And that includes two heavies, or three heavies.
I think it's three heavies. The thing about that Gorshade list, as soon as people understand how it works, I think it loses some efficacy.
Yeah, they can tech... You can start... looking at how to dismantle it, and
even if you're not teched for it, if you have a game plan for playing against it, I think you'll be all right. We should probably explain. Maybe he wouldn't appreciate it.
He might not appreciate it, but
we love doing this to Will. So
the list includes Dara Wraith, and Gorshade, and the Gorshade one and the Deathwalker, Deathjack, Nightmare, and a Reaper. That's what it is. Yep. Is the other heavy and a Reaper.
I wonder why it isn't the named Reaper, Malice.
The actual Reaper has Reach.
I was just thinking Malice Camp Souls.
Yeah. Reach is pretty good. And Sustained Attack, pretty good.
Yeah, they're both amazing. Anyway.
Because the Reaper is part of Assassination Plans, and then Sustained Attack becomes more. At any rate, and then the list also includes 20 Mechanithralls with Surgeons and Commanders. And
that's most of it.
5, 6, so that's 8 points per Mechanithral unit. 16. 28 with the Deathjack. 38 Nightmare. 45 Reaper. I think it's 7 points. Yeah, 45 Reaper.
There's probably... I didn't see all of the lists, but I'm guessing that there's probably some Sirens.
Probably 40, but that's 45 of it.
Anyway, conceptually, what the list does.
Maybe a stalker.
Is it tanks like a boss?
Yeah. and Derek, right? And Dara. So, it's pretty close. Anyway, so yeah, the idea is that Deathjack, the heavies form kind of a wall. Behind the wall sits Dara and the Deathwalker, creating this -4 to damage roll / strength field. For living models that come into it. So, like, a Hordes faction that's trying to crack it is actually trying to crack an Armor 23 Deathjack and an Armor 22 Nightmare and an Armor 21 Reaper that all have Defense 13, which is difficult to do. Like,
yep.
It's a pain in the ass.
And then you also have Gorshade's Feet. So that if which
Gorshade's Feet, which... I've dismissed out of hand Gorshade 1 for so long because he was just inferior in all respects to Asphyxius 2. Because his defensive measures, while good, are not as good as Hellbound plus Clouds.
True.
His feat, while good, is clearly not as good as Spectre Legion was. And then his toolkit pales badly in comparison to Clouds and Excarnate. He does have Hexblast, which is a very nice toolkit spell. Now, though, his feat is probably better than Spectre Legion.
Because those guys hang out?
The guys hang out. It's six thralls as opposed to 9 knights and 1 thrall, which is what Asphyxius's ideal feat is. They stay around, but the damage potential is similar. It is significant enough to remove a colossal in most cases, when that's what you need to do. Especially with Hexblast available to more reliably remove upkeeps than Asphyxius ever could. His defensive toolkit is good enough. Shadowmancer is an excellent like, he's a stealth caster. Like, holy crap, that's really good. Like, just playing P. Denny, especially when he's not susceptible to some of the assassinations that P. Denny is, like Epic Sorcia plus blast damage.
Does Shadowmancer make his battle group stealth too?
Yes.
So
the Deathwalker is included in his battle group.
Yeah, so the it's basically creating a situation where the only way you can kill his Jax is with melee.
Yep.
And the only I'm sure it's primarily his hordes drop. So then if you bring your beasts into him, they're all -4 strength.
And the Deathwalker generates a -2 defense effect as well. So the Mechanithralls can get turned on against certain targets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the recurring Mechanithralls, like, seems pretty strong.
Yeah. So it has some options, and it plays differently enough than some Crix lists to be an interesting choice. Because at the same time, you need your standard Crix solutions, because there are 20 Mechanithralls on the board. That's a significant problem that recur. So if you can't scalpel out Stitches and you can't deal with the mechanic and don't have the volume of attacks to deal with the Mechanithralls, you will get overrun. At the same time, you have to be able to deal with the pseudo armor skew with a reasonably high defense. So conceptually the list is certainly very interesting.
Kill the Deathwalker.
Yeah, it's a question of, can you kill the Deathwalker? Like, can you remove Dara? Which is very... I mean, you can see him.
Dara is very healthy, difficult to remove.
He's bastard to kill.
Yeah.
14, 17, guy. 10 boxes.
And then the dismount.
And then the dismount.
What were we talking about this in reference to? I forgot.
In reference to factions being able to... That Kador and Crix specifically lack the ability in a meaningful way to play both a Jack-based and an infantry-based game.
Gotcha.
And we're presenting a couple of the options that Crix has, but that it is not nearly as diverse as Signar nor
Protectorate.
Particularly Protectorate. Like, it's definitely, if we have just like...
Although I would argue that Protectorate troops are good, they're not as good as...
Yeah, they're incentivized towards a Jack-based play, with an option for troop-based play, that it certainly exists.
Yes.
Signar is incentivized towards troop-based play, with a Jack-based play that... Or supported by Warjacks, with a more Warjack-centric play being possible. I think they have more trouble switching back and forth in a meaningful way than Protectorate does. But still have the option. Then Crix has like strong infantry based mechanics with one or two exceptions that still function. And Morten Ebra, she doesn't function in the same way that a standard list does, because I don't think that list has a long game.
I don't know. I've never seen that list go past turn two. I have no idea. So.
Because Morten Ebra doesn't present enough survivability, like enough additions to survivability, to keep that going for too terribly long. Especially that list is built with no screen in front of it. It's built to like unwrap your list and kill your caster, which it does more effectively than most lists can.
Just clearly. Talking about Tom Guan's list bring up some negative emotions.
Who?
Tom Guan.
Who?
Your buddy.
I don't know who we're talking about.
Your former teammate.
Who?
Maybe if you hadn't pissed on your leg at TempleCon, you'd still be teammates. I'm just saying.
I literally have no clue what you're talking about.
He didn't piss on his leg. It was Epic Striker.
Striker!
Yep.
And then I think Kador, poor Kador at the bottom of the pile.
It's infantry.
It's such an infantry-focused play.
It's not even that it's just infantry, because that's what Crix has been. It's that it's the exact same kind of infantry. It's like, you look at any of their lists, and I mean, Black Dragons started making people play, and people have been playing IFP a little bit more, like, lately. Mm-hmm. But I remember a year ago, or maybe a year and a half ago, or whatever, it was just arm 11 on arm 11 on arm 11, like, all day long, and maybe you got up to 13 if you put Winter Guard in one of your lists, mm-hmm. and it never got any higher than that. And so you just, how many templates can I put on the table against Kador? And then I
definitely feel like over the last 6 months or so, I've played against more IFP than Kazi Assassins. Like, I just...
Kazi have kind of gone on to Vogue.
Which I honestly love. Like, because I think I personally love IFP, but yeah.
It's also going to be a good time to bring them back because the countermeasures for Kayazi are going to start finding their ways out of lists.
Well, that's, we see less Menoth lately than we've seen in the past, and that alone is usually a...
I think Menoth is struggling right now.
I mean, I don't know, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember back in the day, like, I used to think of Kador not specifically as whatever caster they were playing, but as...
Iron Flesh plus.
Can I kill defense 18 or higher infantry, you know?
The biggest problem for Kayazi, just why the list got away, isn't blast damage. It's Colossals, but it's not necessarily blast damage. It's because a Colossal occupies 5 inches of space that it's almost like difficult terrain having to get past it with Killstroke. So then you only have an efficacy of 4 inches with Killstroke to get their stupid caster. Like, you just find that alone is enough to make them not worth taking.
But the Kayazi can, yeah. The Kayazi can kill the Colossal.
They can sometimes, like battle-lusted ones, but you'd be, I don't know.
They don't even necessarily
They don't
have to
kill
be.
Stormwall.
Yeah.
Because they can't get there.
And that's why IFP
they is have the same. They have the same problem with Conquest in the mirror, because they can't get there. They'll die going through the creeping barrages.
No. Only like...
Not all IFP
60%
are,
of the time.
Not all Kayazi are solid.
also true.
Sixes to kill them is like 65, closer to 70% of the time.
Then you just tough some. All right, you can't do that either.
Just a Rusk.
Kayazi suck.
I think Cotter players should put Piper in the list more often.
Piper, and they should play solid ground casters.
I do agree that Colossals were a hit to Kayazi in favor of the Iron Fangs, who aren't a great deal better against Colossals, but are somewhat better.
Actually, the Iron Fang are a great deal because they, even if...
They're a great deal better against non-Stormwall Colossals.
Yeah, because they're more resistant to... Yeah, Stormwall just has the covering fires, which are amazing. But yeah, they can also absolutely leapfrog in there.
What I love about Iron Fang is just the amount of board control they give you. That many reach a-holes.
Yeah, but one thing that, like, as me as a player, as I've reincorporated them into my list fully, Mat 6. Oh, my God. I just forgot about Mat 6 for a while there. That's pretty in a faction that has a hard time. You know, Signs of Portents is, like, the big one. Yeah. And then P-Eros Feet, who I don't even take P-Eros anymore.
Wait,
are we praising Mat 6?
No,
he's complaining.
Okay, Mat 6.
Oh, God. Right. I forgot that everything wasn't Mat 8 or 10.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I actually hate Mat 6. Mat 6 drove me out of Legion.
Like,
literally drove me out of Legion.
Just roll 6s and 7s.
Sorsha, Freezing Grip / her feet makes them much more viable, but that's not how you personally play Sorsha.
Yep.
There are enough casters that do that I kind of think that's almost become, or almost might become, rather, the new Iron Flesh. Yep. It's not, do you have Iron Flesh? It's, can you get Iron Fang Pikemen to hit things?
Yep.
All of the Vlads can.
I don't mean to tangentially, like, we don't have to talk about her freedom more than a millisecond. Sure. But Zerkova, that's why she's back in my rotation, is just Icy Grip.
Because she has a -2 defense.
Yeah, it's a huge problem solver for, like, the Greyler turning cavalry and IFP.
Her feet is really good.
Her feet's really good, all right, but it's okay.
Your millisecond's up.
Yeah, my millisecond's up.
Her feet's fine.
back to Pokemon.
Her feet is incredible against melee-based troops.
Yeah.
You see a lot.
Unless they're all weapon masters.
What about just the fact that IFP have CMA, combined melee attack?
That's good, but you're like when you're targeting like infantry. Even okay defense infantry, it sort of sucks to just sort of get five attacks.
When you're going out, like, I'm a 10-man unit, you're a 10-man unit, let's fight. And they need fives to hit you, and you need eights to hit them. Like, having to combine is not good times.
I just saw Nate play against Lance today at the shop, and he popped P. Irisk's feet. And sent his IFP in versus Lance's IFP. And I was like, this is a lock. Like, this is like they're just all going to die. This is amazing. And then he just missed probably 7.
Yeah, that defense 13 is miserable.
Yeah, I mean, with Iris 2, you get
fives?
Plus 2. Plus 2. 5s?
5s, like, ouch.
Like, yeah.
4, 3, 4, 4. Like, just wow.
Dice happen.
But, I mean, the fact that just defense 13... 13-14 with Shield Wall, I think, is just... I like that stat line.
That's good one.
I have there are a lot of things I like about IFP, but when they're attacking something else, like, defense 13 vexes them, defense 14 can almost confound them at times.
Yeah, I mean, when you do a two-man and you still need a 6 to hit,
like,
I hate 6s with
it. Yeah, that's sweating bullets. You get 5 attacks, you need 6s.
Yeah, you're like, just like,
that's a bad turn, possibly.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, So yeah, I think that's sort of the new test for quality in KDOR casters is like, if you're going to play IFP, it's like, can you make them effective?
I mean, I feel like sixes to hit is a much bigger problem, like from your base experience of Legion compared to the K, like, right? Because like sixes to hit on high value attacks versus sixes to hit on your infantry attacks, yeah, that's a pretty
big
difference.
Spend an 8-point unit's activation, and if you have a UA, it's a 10-point unit.
No, I...
And you make 5 attacks at sixes to hit, and you miss 3 of them.
Yeah.
So you killed 2 infantry models with your 10-point. Like, it's the same exact thing as activating a 10-point beast and getting no value out of it.
I have no problem rolling the sixes one-on-one. Like, against sending IFP into a Def 12 unit, I feel very comfortable with.
Sure. Yeah.
Sending them into that Def 14 when you have to do the two-mans where their value can plummet. Like, is having... Think about having IFP try to fight Blood Witches.
Or Nyss.
Yeah, I mean, Nyss are obviously like a bad matchup for the IFP. I don't disagree with that, but...
And I understand what you're saying, too, because IFP do something a little different in that they tarp it.
Right.
So you get value out of the board control and denial that they give you of, you know, putting something more valuable behind them. But they're still a 10-point investment, so...
That's true.
Like, Mat 6 is a big deal.
Yeah.
It's interesting. There's a lot of these really interesting breakdown points in the math of War Machine. You know, Def 13 is sort of a magical number.
It is.
You know?
Yeah.
Mat 7 is sort of a magical number.
Yeah, no, agreed.
Agreed. You know, like, it's pretty interesting.
So, I mean, that still leaves... That's a significant stable of casters that perk them up quite a bit. Both Sorshas, mm-hmm. I think, are good enough to be able to work with them, especially since Sorsha 1 is by virtue of feet / freezing grip. Yeah. Sorsha 2 is by virtue of she's going to have the winter guard, so like the high defense problems will get solved.
Well, also...
And she can freezing grip.
With her, it's all about just a big CMA and double damage. Like, they just absolutely end something.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's got the tools to make them work. Vlad, 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 obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, signs importance makes them god monsters.
Yep. Hey, Vlad.
I love the Vlads.
I just wish Irisk his shoulder
one,
pads weren't so retarded.
Maybe.
Yeah, anything with Battle Lust and Fury. Like, Irisk 1, because he helps him hit. But Butcher, again, if you use him, I actually strip him down.
Battle Lust is enough.
Yeah, I don't use him for Tar Pit at all. I just use him as they blow up Colossals, or they blow up, you know.
They're just a hammer.
Yeah, they really are just a hammer, and then they can, like, mini feet and go forward and board control a little bit, or they can, you know, Iron Zeal, whatever, whichever version.
So, yeah, almost every KDOR caster has something that they can do for IFP. Battle Lust is enough that you turn their attacks into a different variety of effective. Mm-hmm. You're not looking to target
troops,
other infantry models with them, so you bring something else for that purpose. But yeah, they're kind of an all-axis unit. Anyway, this is all by way of saying that, like, KDOR is very, very infantry-focused, and they don't have... Because, like, forgive me, KDOR players, who I'm about to offend, but Karchev is a gimmick. He's the worst caster in your faction.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, I definitely agree.
I'm trying to think if I actually agree with that, because Karchev actually...
There's a level of Karchev's game, if you play it properly, that's actually quite effective, which is the having a, like, two boats of mechanics, and then, like, a Spriggan Behemoth Devastator, and then you just... Destroyer, and you just, like, move up, shoot, back up, repair, move up, shoot, back up, repair.
Having him just, like, be an emergency evac vehicle?
Yeah, because they're aiming. They're all rat 6 every turn he moves. Yeah,
that's what I thought about playing him that way, and I wondered if it would work. I didn't ever try.
It works.
It's effective. It's hard to be relevant in scenario long enough.
Exactly. That's the big problem.
To get the attrition done.
Because you've
got
40 points or 35 points locked up in just, like, a traveling gunboat.
But he also has a range 10 knockdown spray.
Yeah.
So, I don't know that he's the worst caster in KDOR. He's certainly in the bottom.
Yeah.
Bottom
tier. He's not good. I'm sorry.
No. You're fine. I was honestly just thinking if I actually agreed with you if he's the worst.
That's fair.
And I'm not sure.
I'm willing to entertain the discussion.
Yeah.
I'm like, when I see someone playing Karchev, I'm just like,
yeah.
Like, okay, as long as Beast 09 doesn't get to me with his 2 focus, I guess. Like, as long as I survive a 2 focus Beast 09 and or a 2 focus Beast 09 can't get to me, like, we're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the best he can do.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, he definitely can slide you out.
And I feel like there isn't, like, Harkovich isn't viable in a, maybe. Maybe.
I actually do think Harkovich is actually worse than Karchev, but
maybe
that's my
has a jack.
I legitimately liked Flanzer's list when I played against it. I was annoyed,
but I think overall there are going to. I'm trying not to be too absolutist while at the same time making a valid point that there in KDOR is the hardest to play
multiple jacks,
a diverse between unit based and warjack based.
I agree. I actually agree with that. Potentially,
maybe we should just state our opinion and then let people decide. You know,
yeah, no,
or
actually,
like even ask for their opinion. Like,
I think there's a potential play style with Kador where they can play some of their medium based stuff in lieu of more jacks.
Just like sort of
Shield March makes.
Yeah, just draping the point back on it. The whole topic was of the four factions. You know, like, you know, has War Machine sort of stagnate a little bit for all of us? You know. For the War Machiners.
Well, it's important that there be some sort of identity to the factions if you want it to continue to be like a, like,
so
right,
the ultimate
like,
toolbox
like,
faction, Mercs over there. I guess they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean,
they
have
to do whatever they want, but they have to build a Rube Goldberg
right.
machine to do most of what
and
they
I
have.
Still have.
It's the nine of all trades, the act of none.
Yeah, that is 100% correct. Yeah. And I have the Kador problem that I can't really build a jack heavy army, but it's for the opposite reasons. Like, my jacks are cheap and they have good speed and reach, but they, you know, hit like
noodles.
Like noodles.
Yeah.
Like really wet noodles.
And I think it's proven in some of these innovative list designs that there are directions that can be explored to create these. Like that Gorshade list of Wills
sure.
feels still very in the Crixian theme. But it is something different.
Yes,
I think every faction has the ability to play like at least one or two lists that are out of character for the faction and do so in a way that is interesting and probably competitive. But it's also good. I think it's good for the game that the factions have like a this is the faction you play if you want to do this kind of play, and this is generally the strength of this faction. Like, I think that's good for the game design and good for selling the game.
Yeah, and I want you to hold on to that thought,
okay?
Because I think Hawk actually posted a really good question about how do you bring a player to the right to playing the correct
scoop that I'm used to.
You did, but he said he wanted to hear other perspectives besides just like a single podcast. And I think it's an interesting topic we could discuss. Plus, I'm sure you guys screwed it up. So,
well, yeah, never mind. I was about to get snooty and elitist. I'm pretty sure he asked me, John, personally.
He also posted on the forums, and he asked all of the podcasts and or anyone else to weigh in. Mm-hmm. So it's a topic we could talk about.
What's the question?
Like, how do you
direct a new player to a faction?
Not necessarily a new player. How do you direct a player to a faction that better fits their what will, because you see a lot of players hop around, like, how do you direct them to a faction that'll make them happy with what they're playing? And it's often in relation to new players, but a lot of times you see players, they move from faction to faction to faction until they stumble into the one that works for them. Like,
some
when,
people never find it.
Like, Crump plays Circle, for example. Like, when Crump plays Circle, he is a different player. And I cannot even explain it to Crump because I don't understand it. I watch him play Circle. I don't know what the hell he's doing. And then suddenly he's up like 30 points. Yeah. And I'm like, that is amazing. And then I watch him like play anything else. And I'm just like, Crump, what are you doing?
I still don't know what you're doing, except this time you're down 30 points.
Exactly.
Are you a fan of Dustin Hoffman films?
Yeah, Rain Man.
Have you familiar with the term idiot savant?
Yeah. No, a circle just clicks for him in a way that when you watch him play circle, he just gets it, and it just fits him like a glove. He's happy doing it. When Crump is playing Circle, he likes the game of War Machine more.
Yeah, but then he abandons it. I don't understand why he's like, man, Circle's so sweet, and then he's like, gotta play Retribution.
That's
badly.
That is what I was going to bring out. That there's something that's difficult to combat. It is hard to get kids to take their medicine. It is hard to get people to do what's best for them sometimes, because they'll be like, oh man, this faction is my favorite to look at. And you're like, that doesn't matter. Yeah. Please set that aside for a brief moment. Unless only playing what you want to look at makes you happy.
Yeah.
Like, do the first thing you have to ask yourself is, do the rules matter to you? If the answer is yes, set aside what looks like your favorite for now. We'll come back to
Otherwise,
that.
We would literally all play trolls. And we can't. Because they suck.
I'm playing the perfect faction for me.
Yeah. So, I mean,
as a game store owner example, I don't think I even brought this up on the Muse 2, was like, you have to jump in. Like, so you say you're at the game store, you're sitting at the table, and you see a new player, and he's just, like, looking, and then, like, the stores, the shopkeep will go, hey, you know, what can I help you with? And he's like, oh, I'm looking to get into faction, blah, blah. And there's always, like, two rubes sitting at a table nearby with an earshot who are, like, you know, local experts, and they start shooting their mouth off about, like, well, if you like guns and spells, I'd play Signar. And if you like guns and spells, I'd play Menoth. And if you like guns and spells, I'd play Cotton. You know, you're
so saying, well, these would be explodes. Like War Machine yeah. professors?
Yeah, War Machine.
Much like there are Dota professors.
Correct. So then you have to swoop everything. In, though, and you have to kind of...
what do you mean,
never
Chad?
He has never had an original thought.
Yeah, I don't think he has.
No, that's true.
I mean, in reality, none of us have ever had an original thought because we're all products of our society and the things that we intake, but, you know.
Well, that's fair, but we don't have to admit that to him.
So who said that originally?
I have no idea.
But anyway.
But the big thing that those players say when they're selling a faction is, this game is really well balanced, so pick the one that's aesthetically pleasing, and then...
False.
And false. And it's totally false. As a game store owner, I have to, like, swoop in there and cock-block that sentiment. Like, they are an idiot. And don't listen to whoever, you know, like, I'm going to gain one customer and lose another, but, yeah, you have to, like...
Yeah, but you've already bought your faction.
Exactly.
You've over there, your War Machine Professor.
Get out!
Got your money, GTFO. Exactly.
When I talk to players... I like to ask them questions that tell me about what they enjoy when they're gaming. Mm-hmm. So I'll say, tell me about your favorite D&D character. You know what I mean? And if they say, oh, man, I just love this. You know, I had this dwarf that had, you know, he was a fighter or a warrior. And, you know, I just tanked everything. It was great. And I'm like, Trollblood's probably pretty good for you. Or if they say, oh, I played this elf, you know, and, you know, it was really dodgy and high defense and sort of hit and run and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh, Legion might fit you pretty well. And you can tell a lot about a person, you know, if they say, oh, I played a paladin. I mean, you can kind of glean by what they like to play. So the first thing I ask them, you know, tell me about a favorite role-playing character you played and what you liked about them. Then I'll ask them, okay, you've played Magic. What colors sang to you? What would you really enjoy playing? If they're like, I love playing blue. I love saying no. I'm like, well, you know, Protectorate's really good for that. You know, and so I try to – and I often – when I'm talking to somebody about faction choice, it's usually somebody I know pretty well. So I'll be like, oh, I think you'd really enjoy playing this for this reason. And then I try to have a really good, well-founded in how I see them play games. It tells me a lot about what they would like to play. Like for Keith, for example, all I have to do is find whatever gives him the biggest competitive advantage.
Exactly.
That is what makes him happy because he just loves to crush souls. No and, denial.
and Crick's Harvest is the most souls. So let's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if
soul collection is the worst.
If I'm talking to a player, and competitiveness is very, very important for them, there are some factions that lead to an easier time being competitive early.
So, do you think all of us around this table are playing the right factions?
Yeah, I do. I think we're all pretty set in. Actually, I'm probably the least likely playing the right faction for me.
I think...
Circle? DLC?
Which one? I primarily play Protectorate of Menoth.
Okay.
But that is so antithesis to what I normally play in games. I normally play very fast-moving, hard-hitting... Like, I'm very much a Crix player at heart.
You're a combo player.
Yeah. I can be,
yeah.
But I'm very aggressive, and Protectorate is very not aggressive. So it's a little bit anathema to probably what I should be playing. But that's why I actually really like Control too. So that's why I play Protectorate and have fun with it. But I think my roots are being very aggressive. Like, we used to play Heroes of Might and Magic. You guys ever play that game?
Yeah.
I'd be the guy that always had his hero dead because I tried to get out of my area too soon. Because I'm like, I think I could take this fight. It's really close, but I could... Oh, crap. My hero's dead.
Close fights are the worst in that game. Anyway, staying on track. I think the hardest part is fighting people's perceived notions of what they see. A lot of times, because it's kind of rare that people from window shopping pick the right faction.
You can't.
It happened for me just because.
I did.
It's dumb luck.
It worked for me too. 3 out of 3.
It happened. It worked for me because I know that recursion mechanics make me happy. Like, I'm like, wait, are there recursion anywhere in this game? Oh, look, some undead. Let's do that. Like, I love recursion.
It tends to be a broken mechanic.
I love having not lost anything, but having gained things by the end. Which is rare to do in this game, but the only way it's possible is really with Crix or Legion. And really just Crix.
Yeah. Yep.
So real quick on the Crump question, since we were talking about, like, he's clearly a superior player or at a different level with Circle than other things, would you guys have known Crump enough going in? So when Crump was new, he was a Magic player. Like, what kind of things would you have asked him to suss out that he was a Circle player?
There's no way I would have got him to Circle. Because yeah. Crump doesn't know what he likes.
He doesn't even know why he got into Circle. Like, do you know how he got into Circle? Did you ever hear that story? He came into the game playing Protectorate, and one day, after an arbitrary amount of time playing Protectorate and at our shop, there was a tournament, a really small tournament going on in Des Moines, and he decided, for whatever reason, it's Crump, that he didn't want to play as Protectorate at this tournament because I think it was because it was a Mangled Metal tournament. And he was like, Protectorate sucks in Mangled Metal. I want to play a Horde's Caster. So one of our locals in Ames went, I'm not going to go to that tournament. You can play my Legion. And he was like, sweet, Epic Thagrosh. Want to play that guy. He's legit in Mangled Metal. So he went and he played Mangled Metal all day long with Epic Thagrosh. He had like a blast. Was like, oh, the Fury mechanic is so busted. Like, this is amazing. Like, he did really well his first time ever playing it. Went into the shop with, like, $500 of store credit, and then just randomly bought Circle.
He didn't win. He didn't win $500 from playing Mangled Metal that day.
No, Magic cards.
Yeah. And he, like, pulled a bunch of Magic cards out of his
pocket or whatever. So, I actually knew Crump when he was a Magic player, when we were both Magic players. And the thing is that Crump, as he existed within the world of competitive Magic playing, is exactly the same as he exists within the world of War Machine. Like, amongst, like, the PTQ grinders, and you know, like, you're like, that guy plays Control, that guy plays Combo, and maybe sometimes they play different decks.
That guy,
like,
borrows other people's decks.
Yeah, I mean, he still will only borrow, like, the people that borrow other decks will still only borrow, like, certain kinds of decks. Like, I would occasionally play aggro, but usually control. And those were, like, I would never play combo. And, like, people knew, like, oh, Josh is probably playing blue. If he's not, he's playing red, guys. Like, that's, like, just every time. And that's how most people are within that game. Crump, like, he had no identity as, like a player in terms of, like, he played that. Like, it's literally, like, flavor of the month, whatever he thinks is competitive against the metagame, whatever he can get his hands on. Like, it's exactly the way he is in War Machine was how he was in Magic. Like, he's just... And you're going to get people like that on occasion that are hard to pin down. Yeah. And that's also a legitimate... It's an expensive way to play, I guess, unless you find enough people to loan you stuff. But, you know, that's a legitimate way of playing, too. I mean, there is a small part of me that's that way, and it's why Mercenaries appeal to me, is because it's just like... today I feel like playing Jax. Today I feel like playing a bunch of infantry. I want to play control. I want to play aggressive. And you can do that in that faction. So,
yeah, I mean, I sort of ended up in Protectorate because I made a conscious decision that I wanted to play robots.
Yeah, I remember you saying that you... Because when we initially played back in Mark 1, way back in the day, you were a Crix player.
Yep.
And when I came back and found you were playing Menoth, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Well, he originally started Mark 2 in as Retribution.
Yeah.
And I was a very aggressive Crix player.
Yeah, you were?
Yep.
I mean, Ashlyn got Sackstruck out of games enough times that I quit, so.
I feel like
that happened twice.
Yeah, that's enough times. And you're like, oh, wait, she's on the backboard edge, and she's dead.
With the community being as diverse, like, the people, there's got to be, like, psychology majors or something that we can, like, make a super complex personality test. Like, you're playing Axis and Allies, you're Russia, do you blitz Germany on turn two, opening their butthole for America, or do you just build up as much crap on all your borders as possible? You know, like, there's like a bunch of like little personality quizzes that would, you know, help define which faction you play, and then you could basically be like a Facebook quiz.
So just like a Zimbo quiz?
Yeah, Zimbo quiz, exactly. But I mean, I was just thinking about it, like, after the first time we talked about it, I was like, it would be like an IQ test. It could be like 600 plus questions. I mean, it could be...
War Machine is a complex enough game. Yeah. I mean...
Absolutely.
That's the best part about it.
Yeah. Really, I think the first test is... Are you going to enjoy playing War Machine? Because I've definitely encountered people that it's just like, I don't think this game's going to last. for such for an individual, because
there's some people that don't want to work that hard.
There's a level
it's their leisure.
There's a level of commitment required, I think, for a for a semi-competitive individual. I'm not saying like a full-blown, like if I don't win, I'm not having fun. Like those people exist, and yeah.
So I think part of the I know where you're going.
But even if you prefer to win, I think there's a level of investment to enjoy this game that is non-zero. Like, it is certainly...
I mean, there's certainly enough to know that that's the case, particularly even just in your own faction. Like, we've talked before about the learning curve, and, like, you know, I'm...
The learning curve.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm just... Like, now, like, after a year and a half, like, I'm just to the point where I'm like, okay, I know what things do. For the most part, I now finally know.
Now I can start working.
Now, after a year and a half,
I can start strategizing.
Right, exactly. I'm like, no, it's time to think about how to play the game. Like, so, like, there definitely is a very steep curve. But I do think, and so I think that you're right. I think that for some people who, like, want a complete... minimal level of investment in a game to just like go roll some dice on like, you know, Sunday with their buddies. Like GW's more.
Baby games to babies.
Yeah. But I do think that there's plenty of like the fact that this game is so deep means that there is plenty of room for people that just want to be like, all I really want to do is have a chance to beat like my friends that put in the same amount of effort as me.
Yeah,
like,
that's fine. Yeah.
The biggest problem in War Machine is there's so much room for growth. If one person has a different commitment level, they're just going to be better and kill it.
I think
yeah, the people around them. Absolutely. Yeah. That's true.
I agree with that. I actually have come to find it a strength. Like, I hate to have gone back to the game store well twice in one episode, but...
Please regale us with stories, game store owner.
Just a quick one. Is I used to fret over like losing customers.
That's
like,
game store owner.
A player would come in and they'd get into War Machine. They'd spend like $600, and they're like, you know, nuts deep in it. And then they get beat like five times in a row and they quit.
Is it different than being balls deep to be nuts deep? I've never heard nuts.
That's whatever.
That's acceptable. Carry on.
Balls is fine.
But then they get like whooped out, and then they bail. And it's sort of, I used to like lose sleep over it. And
yeah, right.
I used to really
rubbing your hands together. I will buy back your army at a quarter of what you paid for it.
But no, now my psychology on this changed.
Yeah. I can just see him now. Maybe War Machine wasn't the game for you. Have you thought about trying a cheaper game like Games Workshop?
Duplos.
You know what? How about Magic? It's only $15 a pack.
Anyway, so people would... like.
Well, they'd bail. And I mean, in 2 years of ownership, I've seen at least four people quit because their entry point... Because that learning curve is steep, and the people who invest more, and there is an investment to it, like... the difference between 40K and Fantasy is you can just paint your models nice, be a nice guy, buy your opponent's pop during games, and like back into a tournament win at 2-1 or even 1-2 potentially on your soft scores.
Yeah.
But like in War Machine, if you're not good, if you haven't invested a little bit of practice and you don't know a lot of the stuff, and then you'll see people actually identify that as like a weakness in the game. They'll be like, I just don't play this game enough to ever be good at it, and I don't know all the stupid crap and all the little loopholes and all the blah blah blah, and then they just get out. And I used to like freak out like, oh my god, this game's not for everybody. Woe is me. And now I'm like, this game is not for everybody. Get the fudge out. Like, I'm more like I circle page five more than I do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not a game that's for
everybody. Not as a game store owner, but as a game store frequenter.
That's much less prestigious, and I feel like it's important to recognize that for Nigel's sake.
Thanks, Lance.
Yeah.
I like that you're keeping me down.
Yeah, yeah. Doing my best.
I used to, back in the day, run tournaments, or not run, run leagues at our local store, and I saw dozens of people that would go through that problem, where they would come in, get really excited, you know, about their faction, and start talking, you know, they'd talk about all their favorite models with you, and then they'd play 10 games in a row and lose, or maybe not even get to that point, you know, they'd play 5 games in a row and lose every single one of them, and then you'd never see them again.
I have friends with whom I started the game and learned the game with who no longer will play, who I no longer choose to play against, and they don't choose to play against me just because
no point.
We've learned the game for different reasons and at different paces. The key example is really Marshall. Like, we used to play quite a bit. Like, we learned the game by playing against one another. But he just is looking for a different experience than I am.
Yeah, Marshall's looking to tell a story.
And it doesn't hurt either of us to not play the other one. We're not like, oh, God, like, I just can't play Marshall anymore. F that guy. No, it's just like, eh. Like, he goes and gets what he wants out of the game, and I go and get what I want out of the game.
Yeah.
We can still talk about it with one another. And he tells me cool stories, and I tell him cool stories. Yeah. It's just...
When I preface these little bits with, like, a game store owner, or a game store owner, I'm not trying to necessarily add a qualifier. I'm just saying it's, like, my psychology's changed. Like, so, for instance, you, I used to, like, walk into a game store, and if I saw one of those players, like, I would just identify them as weak, and it'd be, like, fresh meat. You know,
were they
basically
weak?
Be, like, because blood in the water.
Because they didn't own a game store?
No, it's just like, you know, they're, you know, flailing around, like... babies looking to be chomped up, or, you know, like at a tournament, you'd be like, if they're asking you what your stuff does, anybody who actually has to see your cards in a tournament, I feel like has already lost the game. Like, that's just sort of the way. But and when I bought a store,
I feel that way when I'm playing Pirates.
I'm totally going to start asking for everybody's cards every game. Can I see those? What does that guy do?
Ooh, well, luckily your win loss record kind of bears out with that, anyways. Yeah. So, but. You know, when you actually care about them staying around as a customer, like, players actually don't give two craps about some random guy in the store, you know, staying there forever. But, and so they'll, like, beat him repeatedly because it's a free win they can go take in their, like, moral bank, you know, bank lot. They're just like, yeah, I just rocked out today. It's a Wednesday, and I'm better than that guy.
Depends, actually. I used to be really invested in whether people would stick with the gear or not, because for a long time, our store in Ames... was on the fence about whether they were going to carry the product or not, and they were on the fence about whether or not they would even, like, support, like, us having, like, a local, like, a weekly night, like, for playing the game. And so we were just, like, really stressed about, like, we got to build this community up. Like, you know, they really put it on, like, on our shoulders. Like, we got to build this community up. We got to get people playing this game because we really want to have a, you know, permanent space for it.
You guys have had a really interesting sort of trajectory. I mean, I knew you guys when, like, you drive up to our yards, you know, and play with grilling and stuff. I mean... Yeah, and then, you know, you'd have to, like, order your models personally, like, directly from a distributor or whatever. And, I mean, it's been kind of been an interesting growth for you guys. Now look at you guys. You guys are killers.
and it's kind of meta by meta how they treat new players. We've wandered off topic, and I'll bring it back here in just a moment. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to – I think I mentioned this before, that in Madison it was kind of – when I started, at least, for new players, there was sort of a personality test period where it was like, can you handle War Machine? Questions by Jim and Brian and Nathan. Like, they just come in and repeatedly smack you around to see if you can take it. And if, like, you got mopey and blamed everything but, like, the fact that you were new and, like, would quit, we didn't mourn your leaving. Like, and when I got good, I joined the asking questions team.
Of course.
And it was just like, well, he quit because... he's whiner. Oh, well. And so I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's just how different communities develop.
Yeah, in Iowa, I used to press gang, and I don't really press gang anymore.
You sat down P-Sevy with the Avatar.
No, okay. Yeah.
And you
that
beat
happened
them,
one time.
Beat newbies so merciless. It's the same thing. It's just that personality test. Like, can you take a crushing defeat with no hope?
Stop.
Your PG title is, like, it's probably the most shameful thing the Privateer Press has ever done.
Perhaps. But
anyway, In seriousness,
back to my point. What, in Iowa, during the same time period when you were coming up there, when I was press ganging, I was really good at playing matchmaker. And I'd run around and find people that were of roughly equivalent skill levels. As a matter of fact, Finken would run leads because he was the other press ganger. And I would make him, like, intentionally unbalance the divisions so all the sharks were in the same division and just beat each other up. Which
So you just knew which division would always win the league?
No, because you'd have whoever came out of that division usually won the league.
Yeah.
But at least then somebody else could win another division.
It's no different from now. Whichever division Keith is in will win the league. And
did you ever have a malcontent division, which is the Care Bears, and then the one guy in the Care Bear division who didn't feel like he was Care Bear?
Yeah.
We've had that up in New York.
Yeah,
I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah. We definitely
Casey,
had some of that.
Shut up.
I didn't say anything.
That's on you, Keith.
That's on you, Keith. Your words.
Yeah. Oh, man.
You're going to get a rah, rah, rah at the next convention you go to.
But I was always cognizant of the gulf in player skill. So I tried to line up games for people that, because there's not a lot of value for either player if the gulf is so wide that the conclusion is foregone.
Did you ever like watch the Guppy League and like watch some of the games between Guppies and just walk up and be like, your position is effing terrible? Did you ever just do that to me?
I only reserve that for special people that I know can take it.
Fair enough.
I'm in general pretty nice. You know, I actually made a mistake one time. I went to help Billy. I don't know if you've ever met me. Billy Luce.
Yeah.
And I gave him some of my special brand of, yeah, that's terrible, Billy. And then he didn't take it very well.
Yeah.
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 So bringing it back to the original topic, which was how to line players up for their... And we spend a great deal of time talking about how to know if a player is right for War Machine.
This is sort of a fireside chat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fine.
It's actually...
It's sort of touched on... We've actually touched on the newbie section like all over the place. So it's kind of nice that we've sort of been off topic, but on topic too with our...
That's good. Just
I actually like
indiscriminate
the podcast.
Touching. I like that. This is good so far.
This is actually when I love the podcast, is when we actually tangentially get into some really good topics.
Yeah.
So we haven't really come to a good answer for how to line players up with their factions. We've got some tips and tricks, but a lot of times people are going to make mistakes.
Just roll a die.
Yeah.
No, that's terrible.
No. You can...
Something that's probably become apparent, like as we've talked about it more and more, is that there really is no easy answer. Like we've all got like these different, like wildly, like you know, twisting and turning, like anecdotal stories about the different experiences that we've had, like with this exact topic,
mm-hmm.
and how we've never really. You know, I don't think there is an easy answer to it. I think that the answer is just you have to either get really lucky, you know, in picking a faction, or like it does take like a small amount of dedication where people have to know themselves better than you can know them.
Yeah, and in some ways, you have to like your faction. For most people, I'd say you have to like your faction both rules-wise and aesthetically, which can be difficult.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I've had some people be like, I can't play this faction because the robots look dumb. I'm like, well, you don't have to play the robots. And they're like, oh, well, that's interesting. And then we maybe get them into it, maybe get them into a different one. And I've had, like, for my personal, just the people that I know how they've gotten in the game. Like, I got in because I was like, aesthetically, the undead and I usually get along. And rules-wise, the undead and I usually get along. So let's go that route. And it worked out pretty well. And then I branched into Signar, which was one of the other original factions I was looking at. Because I was like, mages with guns, hooray.
So you would say that you really relate to power-hungry liches?
Indeed. I gravitate towards
people
the power-hungry
psychopaths.
Yeah, indeed.
People willing to sell their souls for power.
So it actually, like, it makes perfect sense within the context of War Machine. It makes perfect sense within the context of his general day-to-day life. But every other game he plays, he's like, if it's not really cooperative, I don't want to play. I do not understand what's happening.
He actually, this is an interesting tidbit about Keith. We might as well psychoanalyze for a minute.
Yeah, let's go ahead.
He cannot handle betrayal.
That's true.
Yeah.
At all.
He hates you.
Even a little bit.
In the context of playing non-War Machine related games, you are enemy number one. Yeah, because you're the most betrayee.
What?
Yeah. You are the biggest betrayer.
You are the...
That's fair. Like, I can often handle games where it's understood that, like, it's like we are fighting in opposition. Like, I can play Battleship. That's acceptable. Like, the rules are clearly defined. I know what you're trying to do. I'm not going to be mad when you hit my little ship and be like, yeah, that was my only prayer. But when it's like, we could be friends or we could be enemies, it like the turn and turn is just, it's something I can't stomach for one reason or another.
He cannot handle betrayal.
At all.
He literally cannot handle
betrayal. That's fair. And I don't think I'd ever realize that in such succinct terms. Like, I've identified it in which games I like to play and don't like to play. And it's not even that I can't handle personal betrayal. Like, I can play Battlestar, where it's like you betray the team, like this, because you're on a different team. Like, I understand teams fighting against one another. We just don't know who's on which team.
Yeah, but you would not be able to handle it if the other Cylon legitimately screwed you over by trying to help the humans just because.
Just because, yes. Yeah. That would
drive
me,
you insane.
I'd be livid.
I still remember the time we were playing with Travis. Do you remember the time that he just tossed in a card to see what would happen?
Yes. And he wasn't...
He wasn't a Cylon?
You can't do that in Battlestar.
He legitimately was like, well, this is kind of boring, so I just like tried to tank a check to see what would happen. Suddenly everybody's on a Cylon hut.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness to Keith, I hate people that ruin games like that because the, like,
because they're not playing to the rules.
Yeah. Like I'm fully in. Like I'm the opposite of Keith. I love backstabber games. Love them.
We played. What was that game called?
Avalon
at James with the most recently. Something about mobsters.
Oh yeah,
The Family.
It's not called The Family, but it's like a mobster like
werewolf game.
No, it's not a werewolf game. Like it's a board game, and you nothing personal.
Nothing personal.
Which is which Keith was like.
I was very leery of it going in, and I'm still kind of wary of it. But this game is more okay for me because it's sort of because everyone is playing for themselves, and there is no such thing as a team victory.
Yeah.
And there is really no such thing as a lasting alliance of any variety. But it was still, like, in the murky waters of, like, oh, this could be uncomfortable for me.
I don't know why you guys have such a problem with me. I'm really easy to play.
I like to play backstabbing games with you because I feel like I 100% get you killed, like, right away. Like, if I'm in a backstabby game with you, like, werewolf, I'm just like, God, this is easy. Like, I know what the first turn is kill John. I know how to get everyone to do it.
I don't know why I get killed in werewolf right away.
Ask Josh. He seems to know something.
Actually, it's really fun for me to go to conventions and play a game of werewolf because I'll get to play one game.
Uh-huh. And then watch.
No, I'll play through an entire one game, usually. And then after that, I immediately get killed.
Oh, I see.
Because people figure out that I pay attention.
Because I never play the first game.
That too.
At any rate. So we've been dancing around a couple topics about moving people into the right War Machine factions, which is very difficult. Getting people through the learning phase of War Machine, which is also very difficult, or deciding whether or not that's something they're going to do into the right level of enjoyment for the game for them, because there's definitely different varieties.
Do you want to define
characteristics? I'm actually not even sure.
Characteristics? Go ahead.
I'm done with that old topic, because I was going to say, like, something that I used to say to people, and it's kind of touches on, I'm one of those game store people that Nigel was talking about, basically. Because I was the PG in our area. And I would tell people that they should pick their faction based on aesthetics, because that's what typically gets people the most excited about the game.
Sure.
And then the point that I would make was that, because you're not going to stay excited about a faction if you don't like its aesthetics.
Actually, in a weird way, I totally agree with you. Like, I think if you were giving yourself advice, or Keith, or, like, anybody sitting at this table, if you gave them that advice, that'd be 100% accurate, because we'd be good at whatever the hell we wanted to play.
Well, that's the point that I would always try to make to them, is I would say, like, you should pick a faction based on aesthetics, because it's really hard to stick with something if you don't like the aesthetics of it. And then, once you find out the game is diversified enough that once you find out the style of game that you like to play, you can probably find a list or a build or some kind of, like, thing that works towards that style using the aesthetics that you have chosen.
Slight counter to that.
Sure.
And this is one, I mean, it's at least three times in the last 2 years, which is, I say that, or something that gets said, and that's what they buy into. Again, I think you're totally right. I think, like, a normal, rational, like, smart guy player who's going to be good at whatever they play. But this player is like, shock troopers. That's what I like. And then every list is shock trooper, shock trooper, shock trooper. They've got the bombardiers and...
Oh, God.
I mean, that's... You know what I mean? Like, they go...
Yeah.
You just need to get them into trolls, so they go warders and champions.
That aesthetics thing can get people in some bad tangents. Yeah. And then they hate
your
guts.
That's true. I guess that they're taking, like... And you're right. You're absolutely right. Because I've seen that happen. I've actually, like, been the instigator of that.
Cotter is always the number one.
The thing is, like, I feel like that is an issue of... miscommunication.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm not saying aesthetics in terms of, like,
an individual group of models.
Like, right, like, exactly. And because they might take that and say, like, oh, that he means, like, a theme. Like, and that, then I need to build around that theme.
This is precisely the reason why I was initially so abhorred. I was so radically against theme forces, is because of what they do to new players.
They drove me crazy as a PG. Like, they drove me crazy because people would read the book and that's the very first thing in the book. and they would be like, oh, I get bonuses for taking this cool themey army that I was already going to like. Those are my favorite guys anyway.
Trenchers? Those are trencher theme?
No.
This is amazing.
Especially with the GW converts, and they love that like list variable you know, side crap. Ugh. Anyways,
but
anyway.
As bad as you guys think it might be, I was gonna say faction, it's the worst on the market.
I was gonna say after I would give my spiel about like aesthetics and like try and point out all the faction and everything, they would be like, it would happen like once a week or once a month at least. Like some guy would be like, oh yeah, yeah, that's cool, yeah. Hey, those gators look pretty sweet. And I'd be like, no, stay away.
We all tried so hard. Do you remember Adam Crumpton when he started? And he was going to start Legion. And then he's like, I've just decided that I want to play Gators and I want to play Pigs. And we're like, Adam, you're not going to be happy. And then he's so angry all the time.
He's so angry.
And we're just like, Adam, we tried to tell you over and oh, he's like, I just don't understand. We don't have a fully developed faction and they're not releasing new. Like,
it's like Gators and Pigs, that's a fine choice for your second or third faction. You know, or later, but don't start.
Well, there's not a lot of depth there because it'll eventually become like Mercs, where there's a lot of depth, but it's just not there yet. I remember back when you played, Mercs were very much where minions are today.
Absolutely,
because you wanted to play, like you shoehorned yourself into playing.
I mean,
Mercs.
I was like an early Merc player, and I played it because I actually just didn't like the four major factions. Yeah. I didn't, but I liked the game, and I wanted to play the game.
So he's legitimately like the Searforged player. He was like the Searforged players are today.
That's not remotely true.
No, it's totally true.
There was no...
Because you played something that was inferior and lacked depth.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to play it.
I mean, that's true.
Just like Searforged players.
That's not why Searforged players play Searforged. At no point was I like, man, this Ashlyn list can totally stand up to your Scar Bob. At no point was I like that. At no point. The Searforged player is just like, these taking two or three units of tactical arc in this core solve all my Crix problems. Like, that's a huge difference in vision right there.
Oh, Lance, I'm sorry.
Oh, my goodness.
We're really not very good at endearing ourselves to groups of people.
I mean, Merc players, I love you. You're my brothers in coin, but some of you are...
So would it be
crazy?
would it be an interesting thought exercise to classify some of the factions?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, because the big one we talked about on like Muse 2 was blue, like a control deck or like a aggro deck or a recursion deck, etc., etc.
Sure,
they actually carry over to War Machine quite well. You really, if you think about it. And then you can kind of point them not only to just, like, the faction they probably want to play, but even, like, the units. You know, you actually start getting them a kind of specific grocery list if they really think about it. Magic's the easiest one. War Machine, or, like, 40K or Fantasy is really hard because that's all over the place. As far as, like, there's an insidious type of gamer who's really competitive, but it's a very specialized form of competition. It's almost like, imagine a polar bear who only kills baby seals. Like, that's his specialty, is he only hunts baby seals. And so what he's done to do this is he knows the rules up and down, and he's actually quite good and technical, but and he has his armies professionally painted, and he pays to have that done, and then he acts like a used car salesman and, you know, buys them, like, free sodas and basically whatever when they play, and he only is interested in clubbing those baby seals. He has no interest in stepping into, like, War Machine and playing against guys who will just run his butt over for about 10 weeks, like, while he figures the game out. Like, he's got no interest in that. So, like, finding those players, like, sussing out that guy is actually really hard. Like, game, yeah. But based on that, because it's like Blood Angels, you should be playing Crix. But that's
it doesn't
quite,
work that way at all.
It doesn't work that way.
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's very different.
You actually cannot map factions in the Warhammer games to factions in...
I actually think it's probably a mistake, with a possible exception of Menoth, to map them to something like Magic either. Like, I think it's much more useful to people that are listening if we talk about them in general terms as opposed to other specific games, because what if you've never played that game?
I was going to say. I agree.
So here's what I would say. I'll start with Legion. Legion is what I would classify as a glass hammer. If people get a hold of your stuff, it goes away really fast. Typically.
Yeah, it does.
It doesn't.
I actually, unlike a lot of other mercenary players, I love playing against Legion because, like, eliminate, charging eliminators, kill Angel.
Legion in general is fast and ignores terrain, so you get to choose your engagements a lot with Legion.
They make the best use of the table because they ignore a lot of rules that apply to the table.
Yep. You have to play very tactically.
They do. But they also play a lot of beast-heavy armies. So if the, you know, playing dinosaurs is exciting for you and you want to play stuff that has probably a lower volume of attacks but a higher quality of attack, Legion is kind of an elite force that moves very quickly, is a glass hammer, and makes the best use of terrain in the game.
But again, there's probably some variation to be had here. Like, I see a Kallus is probably criminally underplayed.
Sure. I mean, you can play other play styles in Legion. I'm just going as a general.
A general. Yeah, right. Sure. Aesthetic.
I mean, that's the point that I was making, is that, like, regardless of what you pick, you can probably find...
You can, but then once you exercise all of those things that scratch the itches that you like, you're going to get bored.
Yeah, okay. That's the point, is that depending on what you pick, you might be really, really shoehorned into trying to fit that style.
Yeah. There is also a subsect of player, and I feel like Chad and I might both fall into this. I'm not 100% about Chad. It may just be the trolls are just perfect for Chad. But, like, I was initially attracted to mercs for a variety of reasons, played them, liked them. I look at things that other factions can do, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool, but, like, I am also a loyalist at heart. Once I pick something, I'm like, that's mine. This is mine. This is what I do. And so I think there are some people that can pick things based on what is it that attracts you initially, and then you're just like, well, that's what I do. This is what I love. And
hell
I
or
love
high it. Water, yeah. I'm going to make it
yeah,
work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, I understand
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But do you think that my description of Legion is apt?
Yes, I do. Yes. Yeah. That was more
so
to Chad's point.
Though.
Than to...
Would we then say Legion is a lot like Legolas?
It's not as pretty as Orlando Bloom.
Yeah.
Glass
cannon, also uses terrain well, has to do hit and run tactics, drinks a lot of Mountain Dew.
It's also not as annoying as Orlando Bloom.
No, actually, Legion well played is very annoying.
Yeah.
Have you... completely off topic. Have you ever watched a show, Ricky Gervais's Extras?
Yeah.
The Orlando Bloom episode where he keeps trying to get the chick to, like think, tell him he's hot. He keeps talking about, like, he's like, every set I'm on, Pirates of the Caribbean, they told Keira Knightley she would have to do a makeout scene with Johnny Depp, and she's like, don't ever say that again. I'm going to be so sick. And I nearly vomited. And then she went back to making out with me because all the girls love. Like, it's like the whole thing Orlando Bloom is just talking about, like, how hot he is and how women, like, love him and keeps pointing to, like how he's, like, number one on, like, women's, like, fantasy list or whatever. And, like, all these men. It's, anyway, Ricky Gervais's Extras. Good.
Is it really
Orlando good? Bloom's show. That Orlando Bloom episode, pretty good.
Okay. Excellent.
So all right, back.
Legion is Orlando Bloom.
Yeah, that's where I was going with that, basically.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Because it's a lot like JVM.
Yeah, JVM's the Orlando Bloom.
Every time I see JVM, he's just like, Johnny Depp is disgusting. And I'm like, you're right, Jake.
100%.
Immediately rides a shield downstairs and shoots two guys.
Awesome.
If you like to ride shields downstairs and shoot two guys.
If you just love Mountain Dew moments, like if, yeah.
Yeah.
Kador?
Every battle. Kador, what do they be?
Sloppy, fat, gross, greasy.
But that's just me. You're making fun of me now. Let's keep it to factions. Come
on. I'll let Nigel classify Kador. I have some thoughts, but...
Actually, honestly, as the one most attached to him, I have no idea how to classify him. Because all I know is when people come into it, they think, like, heavy armor, blah, blah, blah.
No.
And it's not either the defensive skew, which people think with Kayazis, and it's not the heavy armor. It's more like this giant level of mediocrity. It's like this weird
Dan
Quayle faction.
I was going to describe Kador as a peasant horde. It is often a lot of models...
That costs twice as much as Crix.
Yes.
So really expensive peasants.
Not always. Like Wintergarten really cheap.
It's Russian peasants, right?
Yeah.
But
you have to pay them all the same.
Kador does combined armed infantry really well. They often are a very, very good infantry ranged faction. So if you like to play, but they also can mix it up in melee with their infantry. So, and a lot of their infantry is pretty durable.
Yeah, they've got the closest approximation to infantry combined arms that exists in War Machine pre-Retribution.
They also have it's a faction where, like, the problem with this game is you can't see anything without, like, an exception. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But no faction, in my opinion, does the caster dig his butt out of a bad faction more than Kador. Like, P-Vlad, all the casters I use completely dig out every list I bring. That's like, the list is bad. The caster is amazing.
So let me say that,
where
too.
I win games.
Kador leans on their caster more than about any other faction.
Yeah, like, it defines
their
list.
Their casters
really
are broken as hell, too.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of their casters would completely break other factions.
That's actually, like, yeah, when Who's the that's pretty obvious when Who's the Boss became a format, it started becoming really popular. Because that was almost everybody's answer for, like, what's your best possible, like, wheel spin? And people would always be like, it was always a Kador caster.
Like,
yeah. It was like, Irisk, Vlad, Butcher, you know, it was like nobody ever picked, like, a Signar caster or
and
a
nobody
Trolls or,
ever picks a Protectorate caster.
No.
Yeah, I mean, just look at P. Butcher. I mean, he's like our fourth or fifth best caster. He's like nuts. I mean, his feat is amazing. Fury is amazing. Iron Flesh is amazing.
Yep.
I mean, he's just got
himself.
Is he's a, he himself is like a complete
Yeah, he's a
badass.
Mat 9 power 16 weapon master.
Yeah,
can you get work done with that?
14, 18 with whatever, 18 boxes or whatever.
Yeah, and then Iron Flesh.
Yeah. I mean, he's a complete badass. But and he's like, again, our fifth best guy or something.
That's what I definitely would say about Kador. Is just like, and that's what I was going to say was, Krix may have the best casters in the game, but Kador is 100% the most defined faction, or the faction that is most defined by its casters, because its armies will always look the same, but their goals always, like, the goals and the way that they're used always vary depending on which caster it is that is leading the army.
We talked about IFP earlier in the day. It's like, well, played with these casters, like, mm-hmm. they do a combination of things. Like, played with the Vlads, they're gonna be Tar Pity and fight the infantry, and, like, or if it's an Arusk, like, they'll get Iron Fleshed and really fight the infantry. Yeah. But it's like, no, we're playing them with Butcher, or we're playing them with Arusk 2, where it's like their job is to hang back and not die, so that they can be like magic bombs that blow up anything heavy that they can possibly touch. So yeah. They definitely have, the casters definitely swing the purpose of their pieces more than in other factions. Moving to Krix, Krix is an easy faction to define. It's as much as aggressive as any faction can be. It's infantry based melee aggression. Getting into anything but infantry based melee aggression is something that you have to work at in Krix.
Mm-hmm. You come screaming across the table with Krix.
Yeah, you come screaming across the table with gun or with knives and fists and whips and swords.
Krix
and
is
axes.
Also the primary faction if you're a 40k player or a fantasy player, where the paradigm of list building holds true. It's like the only exception to that rule. Everything else I consider should be combined armed list. Krix is the only one where you just want to pin your ears back. Don't take a ranged weapon. Maybe don't even take spells. You just have a couple, take a couple arc nodes and a crap ton of weapon masters or whatever, or a crap ton of melee, you know, which is exactly how, you know, Games Workshop games, their lists are usually built on some sort of...
Yeah, they're built on this thing called redundancy.
Yeah.
You know, where they have a lot of stuff that is either exactly the same or does exactly the same thing but has a different name.
It's redundancy plus the fact that if you ignore 2/3 of the game, you are clearly the best at that other third of the game, which you then use to bully other people out of, you know, so... And with Krix, it makes it work. They're, like, absolutely phenomenal at it. And their price point and all their units are pretty good.
Yeah. The caster's job, most of the time, is to deliver.
Yeah.
Like, deliver... The two most important things your caster can do is delivery and accuracy.
Yep.
Krix is also the most intuitive army to play.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
It is just because it has the most simple game plan.
Yeah. It's what the initial player always wants to do is like they set up their guys and then their guys march across the table and they fight the guys that are across from them.
What's
and Crix is
the
best at doing
that. Is that nuance? But I do think that intuitively, the average player will have a better record with Crix than with any other faction. But again, what separates the men from the boys at like tournament time is
it's the nuance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the overall strategy and everything else.
But I mean, it is a lot of times mindless aggression. You have to be like, this is different for different factions. Cause we've talked about it with Chad and some of his lists and I've talked about it some too. Is in Crix, you definitely have to be okay with losing some of, or a significant portion of your own pieces before you start to do any work.
Yep.
And there are some factions that do that and some factions that don't. Like, for Crix, it's okay if a third of your army is dead before you make your first attack. In a lot of cases, you're like, I'm still fine. Like, once we get there, I'm way better. Mm-hmm. That's not okay for the Kador player. That's not okay for the Signar player. Certainly not okay for the Legion player.
No, it's an unmitigated disaster for the Legion player.
Yeah, that was actually a thing. When I was learning the game, that was actually something that was a really bad matchup for me, or a really bad match for me in my faction, because I would always lose my mind when I would lose half of my army, like on the Alpha Strike,
mm-hmm.
especially when I would be playing against something that I had no chance of stopping the Alpha Strike.
Yeah,
they're just twice
the Alpha
as fast
Strike
as
will me. Happen. You're playing against the Texas Raiders, like
or whatever. Just, I mean, name a thing. And trolls didn't have reach in Mark 1, and they didn't have Fen Blades in Mark 1. And yeah, so I mean, I would be playing champions, and I would be playing champions and Creel warriors against like Iron Fang pikemen that charged 13 inches, and I would just be going.
So this is a transition into.
But
trolls.
I would be losing my mind at losing half of my army and him still having his whole army, and just about ready to quit the game. It's like, oh well, whatever. Let's just go through with my turn and just. I'm not going to give him the satisfaction of quitting. I'm just going to play. And then I would kill my half of my army left would kill twice as many guys as they were. And then it would be his turn again. And all of a sudden he wouldn't kill anything.
Yeah.
It's like,
oh,
this is actually pretty good.
So
this is okay.
That transitions into the one thing I'll say about trolls before I let you take over is that whereas sometimes Kador gets advertised as this, and it is not true, Trolls is the only faction that can reliably take the first punch and fight back. And that can be your plan. Like, that should never be your plan in almost any other faction.
Any other faction.
In Trolls, it's like, yeah, I'm okay with that.
Well, as we just said, Crix does the exact same thing, just in a different way.
In a different way.
Exactly.
They go kill what you can, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Trolls goes, give me your best shot.
Yep.
Yeah, troll armies tend to shrug off stuff. And you don't even... It's weird, because you don't even realize you're losing against a troll player.
No, you think you're winning sometimes. Sometimes you're like, no, man, I got to Morg. I killed Morg. Yeah. And you're like, crap, the Earthborn just killed the only thing left that could kill the Earthborn. Like, this is like a nightmare. Like, it's like, he was so hard, Mog was so hard to kill, and the Earthborn is twice as hard to kill as Mog was. Like, I don't, good to the last drop is trolls.
Yeah,
to trolls. The last drop.
But it requires a great deal of patience and, like, a relatively cool head
it
as a troll player.
An extremely cool head, which is something that I've had to develop.
Yeah,
to be able to lose models that you care about. Because you don't get to pick which parts of your army live. Your opponent kind of does that.
I'm telling you, I used to... Go ask Nate about it. Go ask Chris about it. Like, I used to lose my mind. Which is why I was so happy when the Champion Hero came out. Because champions, I mean, like nowadays, like one champion is... Even having one champion left is still just amazing because they're power 11 weapon masters. Back in the day, they used to power each other up, like in Mark 1. Every time a champion hit, all the other champions got +1/+1. And so losing two of them... Like more than half halves their like a quarters
right,
their
sure,
game, like
sure.
their output.
Yeah.
And then they came out
it's like Kane missing his first three shots on his feet turn.
Right. Like yeah. The unit basically doesn't do anything anymore.
Right.
Like even just using like losing just one guy is like about half of your damage output.
Yeah.
And then they came out with a champion hero who got he got buffed whenever champions died in his control radius. And I was like,
And so that was like a big kind of turning point for me. Because, like, I mean, it wasn't even that great, but it was still just like, because I used to lose my mind. I'd be like, ah, oh, two champions are dead. I'm like, this game's over. And then the champion hero, I'd be like, oh, well, at least I got this bonus. Like, it's kind of nice. Like, and then, you know, keeping your cool head is kind of a way for you to come back, like,
to see the way out.
Come back in a good way and, like, battle back out. Like, even though, like, you probably could anyway, but, like, it's 90% of this game is, you know, mental.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if I would describe Trolls, I would say they're obviously, we've been talking about, like, they're obviously, like, the most defensive faction. But I would also classify, I think that another big part of the Trollblood playstyle is that they really are, like, a jack of all trades, master of none, like, in terms of offense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they can do anything offensively, but they're not, like, the best at whatever they choose to do. You know what I mean?
No, they're definitely the best at taking a punch.
Yeah.
That's where they're
talking offensively.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's where their strength is. So, yeah. Obviously, if they're the best at taking a punch, they can't really be the best offensively.
They can't really be the best at any offensive variety. Yeah. Hard to see. That's I think, why Trollbloods, and this is apart from saying, like, where Trollbloods stand among competitive factions, whether it be higher up or lower down or what the degrees are. But that's one of the reasons why it is easy to misidentify Trolls as weaker than they may be, is because their strength lies not in offense, which is what is easiest to say, like, oh man, I played this list and it just blew everything off the table. Like, Trolls doesn't...
I also see Trollblood players give up before they should.
Yep.
That's not... I wasn't directing that at you, but it does apply on occasion.
No, I just... I'm just thinking back in my own, like... It's like, this is your life in War Machine. And, oh, man, yeah. I can't tell you the number of times.
That was always... When I played in Madison, it was funny, because we had, like, a specific... It was, like, something that we always identified. Like, we'd poke fun at someone, and it was oftentimes Jim, and I love Jim. But every once in a while, and he would say it himself. He's like, God, I feel like the biggest asshole in the world when I bitch and moan all the way through a game about how bad I'm losing and then pull it out at the end.
I don't feel bad about that at all.
He's like, God, all the time. Screw this game. Like, this is terrible. Oh, I won. Sorry about that. Faction is so freaking broken. Blah, 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 blah. Oops.
I've never felt like a bigger asshole than that time that you espionaged me 5 times. And I was like about to kill you. And like almost like crying. And then like I won at the end of the game and I was like, sorry.
I also will say that Trollblood casters are the hardest to kill.
Yeah, that's
by far.
That's what I was, for the longest time, that's what I thought that their absolute biggest strength was, is that...
I mean, that's definitely a nice strength to have.
Yeah, losing by caster kill is so rare, they're just like, oh. It makes it tough to go into other factions sometimes.
I mean, there are times, like, Chad has to point it out to me sometimes. Like, there are games where I probably had, like, a reasonable caster, but, like, I'm just like, well, it's Madrak, so I'll have to win this game on attrition or scenario. Yeah.
So, I really liked that good to the last drop, though. That was,
yeah, that's probably good. That's 100%. Like, I will break through. Like, I'll identify. I'm like, gotta get this. And then I get those things to happen. I'm like, all right. Like, I'm bloodied, but, like, I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish, and now I'm gonna... And I'm like, oh, right, the Creel Stones pal, like, 13 with, like, the stone strength. And I'm like, Well, crap.
12, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
whatever.
Moving to Signar, just jumping all over the place, I guess. Signar is kind of they are basically Krix's opposite. They are infantry-focused, ranged.
And elite.
Primarily, yes, and elite. You pay a premium for the dudes you put on the table. More recently, they've evolved into, because it's been long-standing that they have trouble taking down armor with, like, ranged infantry is never really going to effectively kill armor outside of some really odd circumstances that Signar cannot reasonably produce other than the long gunner CRA. Like, only really Krix and Retribution can blow stuff up with ranged infantry. Butcher sometimes. Anyway, not relevant. Signar infantry, elite infantry, ranged focused, and then they supplement that infantry removal that their infantry brings with high value attacks from warjacks to deal with armor.
Much like Cador, I feel like Signar leans on their casters a lot.
But in a different way.
Yes.
It's not the sit back and puppet strings the army. It's like a doing work every turn from like a distance kind of. It's like everybody's got an amazing gun. Like, all their dudes. I mean, even Haley, if you really want to just get the two main cannons. I mean, I don't know.
Why does Striker 2's gun cause disruption in his Raider Fire 2?
Yeah.
Striker 2?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Striker! The old Quicksilver. Or no, Magnum. But yeah, so I mean, the Signar caster doesn't as directly, it won't. They don't define the pieces that they play with in the same way that a Kador caster does, but they do define the way in which you deal with your opponent's pieces, I guess, is a better way to put it. Like, if you're playing against heavy armor and your caster is Haley, your plan is probably to control it and not deal with it directly until you're forced to. And you can just chip away at it at your leisure while it sits there doing nothing.
Yeah, and that's also where, like, they have a unique play style that's actually very entertaining. If, like, you're that type of player is, like, gun mages. Sure, they brought heavy armor, and I'm useless. But they're not, because they thunderbolt people away. Like, so they can kind of control, like, I want to make two kind of attacks and then push you so far away that you can't retaliate so much.
Yeah.
And then so on, so on.
Or if you're playing Kane 2, your job, your answer to armor is wait until a crucial moment and then blitz it down.
Yep.
Just get rid of it all in one go. When it's the best, when it's most advantageous for you. If you're playing Sloan, it's chip it down rapidly. Like,
yep.
It's coming away. It's gonna die pretty quickly. But you have to have at least like 4 or 5 turns to do it.
I think Signar is the most heavily ranged attrition army.
Yeah, yeah, and they have some assassinations. I mean, anytime you're bringing quality guns, you're gonna have some decent assassinations. But they aren't. They're not dependent on them. They can play ranged attrition with a reasonable degree of success.
There's other factions that do ranged, I would say, as well as Signar. But Signar doesn't do as well in melee as those factions do. So
Yep.
Ranged focused. Caster driven.
Yeah. I mean, if you like playing gunlines, Signar is for you.
Yeah, but it's such a weird, fun gun line. Like, gun mages is such a weird utility unit that's hard to sort of quantify them. Like, yeah, sure, they own Kricks, and they own, like, a lot of weird matchups, like Kaiazi Assassins. They have a lot of Deadeye casters, so... But that board control scenario play, like, that makes them good against armor without actually being good against armor. Like,
yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, you know, it's a kind of a neat faction.
It's actually
sort of vaporous.
You know what it reminds me of is back in Mark 1 before Circle had Warpro Stalkers, they really had no good way of killing armor. Mm-hmm. So their way of dealing with armor was they would send in their war beasts and then just double hand throw or slam. You know, their way of dealing with armor was effectively like neutralizing it and ignoring it.
Yep.
You know, or whatever.
So rare to see like armor. What's going on?
Nobody played warjacks.
Like Kruger would
Mark 1.
Would basically house entire tournaments. By virtue of his feet. It's like, aha, it kills everything. And by everything, I mean everything that is played. Except Scar's Bane Knights.
Yeah.
That one turn.
Almost half of every game I've ever played with Signar, ever. It's sort of a testament to like how awesome gun mages are and how much they define that faction. Almost half of every game I've ever played against War Machine players has resulted in one of their warjacks being like knocked down in a pool of water. Like, it's just like the easiest thing in the world to do. And it's a huge board control. It's like, if you're a crappy faction that can't deal with armor, doesn't have to deal with armor, that's such a blowout for you. And it's a weird faction. Like, you're doing so many weird things. Like, if you just like those weird movies where they're, like, 7 D-bags up against something they can't deal with, and they somehow win anyways, that's, like, the faction for you. Like, they somehow sort of do it every time. But anyways.
We're not painting a very, very good picture for balance, but...
No.
It's,
Protectorate is an interesting... interesting to attempt to define. Because it's sort of on the troll blood spectrum of how it sort of has a span of things that it's...
Here's how I would define it, Protectorate. I define it as a knot that the Protectorate player presents to you and says, untie this.
So you have to be I guess as a fledgling protectorate player, you have to be good at tying those knots.
Yep, you do, because your positioning is really important. But what you're doing as a protectorate player is you're presenting things like Enliven, the book, Spell Denial, can't target me with spells, good tar pits.
Whoa, real quick, just tangentially, also just note how different their casters are, because that's also another leap in, like...
Yeah, Protectorate is the first faction that we've talked about with the... I guess Trollbloods aren't as caster-driven, but Protectorate is not almost at all caster-driven in some cases.
I think Trollbloods are extremely faction caster-driven.
Caster-driven? Okay.
That's neither here nor there. So.
I mean...
It just turns out all their casters, except for Gumbjorn, are good.
True.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you look at Self-Sacrifice with Errants, Damage Transfers with Bastions, Enliven with Warjacks... Untargetability with spells, untargetability with non-magical weapons. And so as the Protectorate player, every turn, you're trying to tie a knot and present it to your opponent so that they get the least effectiveness out of their army that you can.
You're like, I really want to charge that Warjack and kill it with my Warjack, but it's Enliven. So first I have to figure out a way to deal with the Enliven. Well, can I knock it down? Well, no, I can't because there's a book there. Well, can I kill the book? Well, no, I can't because it's got... I have to do 5 attacks against it.
Yeah.
Or it's hidden behind something or whatever. So is there a way that I can get my guys to block his Enliven Jack, you know? Or is there a way I can, like, you know...
That's why I kind of rudely interrupted with the caster point, was, mm-hmm. like, that whole knot is designed to sort of make... I've got a 14-14 running this, you know? So in the background,
yeah.
like, hanging on Eye of Minoth or Defender's Ward or whatever, I've got a 14-15 or whatever, you know, and who can't camp a lot, have, you know...
So... It's interesting to hear you describe it like that, because it's not how I have thought about it in the past. Because when I think about the statement, I'm tying a knot for you to untie, that's a very, like, proactive thing. Like, that's very much like a, like, here's, like, a problem that I'm presenting for you to solve. Whereas when I've always thought about Menoth in the past, like, I guess it amounts to generally the same thing, but it's more like, you have X things in your army that can do this. I have an answer to the fact that your things can do this. You have X things in your army, they can do Y. I have an answer to the fact that your things can do Y. And so I've always thought about it as less like that you're presenting like a problem for your opposing army, and more that, like, what can you do? I have a counter to that. And Menoth always has a counter to that.
Yeah, but Menoth is the most heavily denial faction.
Yeah.
It... also is blessed with the easiest to kill warcasters, I think, in general.
I mean, almost across the board, Protectorate defensive stat lines are bad.
Yeah. I mean, they are. You're right.
The hunt pretty hard to find good good defensive stats in Protectorate. Same goes for Crix.
That's why we have Defender's Ward.
Yeah,
to
that's
fix those bad stat lines.
That's why.
Some casters do. Yeah. And those are often, like, the Defender's Ward casters are not either the ones that don't do much else for their army, or don't do much else personally, or and are the easiest to kill.
Yep.
Like, Vindictus is not easy to kill, but he doesn't do much else for the army. Severius and Krios are just really, really easy to kill.
So, the other thing I will say about Protectorate, they are the most efficient with focus out of all the factions, except for maybe Convergence of Cirrus, which is sort of a new development. I need to see them played more before I determine if they've overtaken them or not, because Mad 8... Rat 7 through the choir makes all of your focus so much more valuable,
mm-hmm.
because when you buy an attack, like, that's where the power in Protectorate really lies, is in the choir, in the denial that it offers.
Absolutely.
And then the ability to wash focus through a, you know, it's basically like every time I spend a focus to buy an attack with a jack, I almost get a boost out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
On to both ends.
On both ends. To hit, yeah. and to damage, or it's, you know.
Yeah. It's like... It's probably like 2.25 focus.
Yeah.
Just moving along. So that covers the big 4 War Machine factions, the peripherals.
Well, it actually just covers all the factions that we sort of personally play.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We need to really go into everything, you know.
We did cover Legolas, to be fair.
Yeah. I mean, we can also
what
talk...
What did Mercs do, Josh?
Nope.
We talked about them, but when we were picking factions, it was Mercenaries are the ones that where you can do pretty much whatever you want.
There you go. Just...
You have to find your solutions.
Mercenaries are interesting. I'll let you talk in a second. Sorry. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. in that they can do whatever you want, but it's almost always like a manufactured way to do a lot of the things they want to. Like, it's never a, I'm just good at shooting. Well, I'm good at shooting if I take a particular caster, particular units, buffs, Dougal, you know, like all this other, like, layers upon layers of just that you have no idea, and then, you know, suddenly something's money shotted, and you know, it's just
with mercenaries, I would say you have to both know what you want to do and then find the way to do it, where in other factions you can sort of use the faction as itself as a means to discover what it does. That's not an effective way to approach being a mercenary player. You kind of have to know what you want first, which is why it's a tough sell as an initial faction.
They are the worst faction in the game at manipulating dice, which is a pretty significant portion of the game, particularly at competitive level play. So that is their, I think that is their biggest handicap. Their biggest strength is that, yes, like, you can. And it's not, like, you look at it and you're like, oh, this is a super Rube Goldberg. But it never actually turns out to be that big a Rube Goldberg. It usually involves activating, like, your Warcaster and your Solo before you activate your unit, right? Which is not, like, a significant price to pay. But you have to think about it when you're building the list.
It's not in the activation order or order of activations. It's in the as pieces get removed.
That's true. That's true. And you have to... Being a mercenary player, you have to be very careful. You have to carefully identify the pieces that are the most important to your game and make sure you work to protect the ones that are easier to kill. But yeah, I mean, your reward for that is that you get to do literally anything that you want. You won't be the best at it. You're not going to be the best gunline army. You're not going to be the best jack army. You're not going to be the best infantry melee army. You're not going to be the best attrition-based army. You're not going to be the best scenario-based army in the game. But you will be able to play... any and all of those things, and you'll be able to play them competitively. And that's your reward for being a mercenary player. That, and the fact that you will frequently get the, like, sort of niche, cool, weird interactions that no one else really gets to play with, and that's fun, too.
I'll just jump through a couple points on the factions that we don't personally play. I would say Retribution is similar to Kador if you just invert the relative importance of their infantry
and
their
casters.
Like, mm-hmm. Casters go down way down in importance, and the units just sort of do their thing.
Yep,
they're very.
But they're still combined arms.
Yeah.
They're still infantry focused.
Circle is a faction about movement.
Yeah, it's most similar from what we've talked about to Legion.
Yep, they actually have a lot of Legion and Circle actually have a lot of similarities.
They just go about it in a different way.
Yep.
The biggest
Legolas with a bow versus Legolas with a sword.
That is actually legitimate. Like that's mm-hmm. I think you actually just nailed it. The cool thing about Circle is Shifting Stones allow them to do a lot of hit and run things with melee.
Yep.
Which are really cool. And then they have a sprint and.
And they sort of do kind of an inverse, in some ways an inverse protectorate thing, where they're not looking to tie a knot, but every turn, just because of their own interactions, you're trying to untie the knot that your list made itself. Like, God, how do I get this to there this turn? I think I can do it. Like, if I move this here, and then that's this spell, and then teleport. And yes, I can do it. But you have to, like, so it requires the most thinking about your own activations. It's another faction that's not kind to error.
No, the thing about Circle is high skill cap faction, though, because you can almost, with good forethought, do whatever you want any turn. You have very flexible game plans that can change very rapidly.
Yep. Scorn.
Scorn is a very fury efficient army.
Yeah, I mean, they play heavies with a melee.
We're just describing the factions now. We're not really giving them, like, the... You know what I mean? Like, the original, like...
The thing is, like...
Scorn is Legolas with Gimli on his back.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, Chad. But Scorn, to me, is... How do I describe Scorn?
A faction that's really strong, but only weak players play it. That's how you describe Scorn.
Yep.
That's not how I would describe Scorn.
I mean...
I think you just nailed it, John.
Yeah. Yeah, good job, John. That was an excellent description you just gave.
So then minions.
God, you guys are the worst.
Yeah, I'm done with this.
Yeah, okay.
I don't need to
don't play minions is how the rest of this ends. Don't play minions or Scorn. Because minions are bad and you'll be bad at Scorn. So John. So say we all.
What are we?
Scorn in a lot of ways is a lot like Crix. In that, except that they deliver heavies that do a lot of damage when they get there.
Yeah, they'll kill anything.
They
yeah.
do.
The problem that Scorn players face is how to get the heavies there, which a lot of times is just they go forever and ever.
Yep.
Scorn plays the most like what people think Kotor should play.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fair description. Yeah. Like, when you think about, oh, man, the big red machine,
yep.
it's actually the big red elephant.
Yeah. If you're excited about Kotor, if you're excited about Kotor, play Scorn.
Play Scorn.
Yeah.
Nothing makes my butt pucker harder than a bronze back. That has how many base attacks? And they're all 18, like, even the Tusk. F
you. Yeah. It doesn't matter. There it's are, it's like...
Mat 7?
Yeah.
Effectively has like 20 base attacks.
Yeah.
Free charge?
I assume we are dead to time at this juncture.
Well,
we're only like an hour and a half into the podcast.
Three?
We're at 2 hours and 9 minutes, and we did like a 30-minute preamble.
That's true.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just that this was so boring to you, Keith.
The first few discussions I thought went longer than they did, I guess.
Actually, I have a potential discussion topic.
Go.
Uh-oh.
One thing I've been thinking about, I've noticed that in the games where I'm most successful are games that I have thought about a lot of small goals that feed into my larger goal in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting to think about the game in bite-sized chunks and can really help like newer players potentially. So... I don't know, just an example of that. When I was playing against Jeremy Lee at TempleCon, I identified that my Outriders were very, very important to my game plan, and they could not get Crippling Grasp because then they would never be able to spray again. If he just because I had no way, I had no upkeep removal on that list, zero because I play Eris 1 with the Peace Orchard list. So I thought it was so like a lot of my game plan was. Okay, how do I eliminate the arc nodes? How do I draw them forward? So one of my goals was to draw them forward so I could kill them and kill both his arc nodes, thus making my unit safe to come in for a turn and get a turn of sprays on Sarge's feed turn. But that really dictated the entire flow of my game. It's just that one miniature goal of not getting that unit Crippling Grasped.
Yep.
So what's the best way then... How do you create those small goals that will lead to successful greater
goals? It's not enough to like dissect what you want to do against your opponent, but try to imagine what he's trying to do against you and then deny him that with what you can, like especially if his denial is taking out a piece that you think is like super important.
Or offer it to him with a high enough price tag.
I do that all the time with the Behemoth. I will feed the Behemoth. That's 13 points I lose almost every game because I would love for them to kill it and then have everything, you know, because it takes about a bronze back plus to get it done. And so then I can deal with that with, like, you know, Epic Zorsha defeated Great Bears or something. So that's like one, you know, 5 points. I'll lose 13 points, and then I'll, with 5 points, kill their 20 points or whatever. So
you end up ahead in the...
You end up ahead. So you try to set up that exchange. So, yeah, exactly. So, like, in this, as per Keith said, using those turn units to maybe even bait out the arc nodes and get rid of them or...
In that particular game, that wasn't possible. I don't think there was a price tag that John could allocate to allowing that was sufficient enough, because for Crix, it's only ever going to be an arc node.
Yep.
I think in that game, the only acceptable answer would be remove the arc nodes and then offer it to Denegra at a price that would most likely get her killed.
Yeah.
She'd be dead. And that was the whole
game.
She'd be dead. And then I even put the Behemoth forward to force an arc node to come up so he could kill it.
Yeah.
Just so I could kill the Arknode. So I'm like literally trading a 13-piece. Because the Behemoth was never going to kill that much stuff, where 5 POW 12 sprays that pretty much hit auto-hit under Peace Horse's feet was going to kill his entire
army. It's Cricks. It almost auto-hits anyways.
Well, yeah.
So identifying these goals is obviously going to be the hard part. So yeah,
It's a difficult topic to describe. I can give you another example.
It's very difficult to describe just because it requires like that, because that even that specific example, which spawns the discussion, not argument. That's extremely, extremely high level awareness.
It presupposes that's Jeremy Lee's plan, for starters, and then
it's not just that. It's also that it's specifically tailored to a specific set of models versus a specific set of models.
Yep.
Like, that's why it's...
The level of knowledge required to make... And I don't disagree that the logic is sound. Like, if you can identify, like, the domino that you cannot allow to fall, or the domino that must fall for your victory to eventually become certain, that that is what you want to pursue. And I don't disagree that there are games, maybe even every game, where that set of circumstances exists.
Well,
but it's the question of how to talk about identifying it that presents the challenge.
Well, that's a really
case.
Big goal, actually, that he came up with. Like, you can come up with small goals. Like, my goal, a lot of the times when I'm playing casters with debuffs and trolls, is that I want to present my enemy. I want to present specifically, like, units that I want to get the debuff on eventually, with targets that have Hero's Tragedy on them, so that I can get one or two of them knocked down, so that, like, I can get a free Calamity, like, without having to boost a hit,
mm-hmm.
or a free Mortality without having to boost a hit. And, like, that's live in a lot of matchups. And that's just kind of a goal that I have for the game, like, setting forth from the game. It's like, well, you know, what's, like, the best way for killing that unit?
Like, yeah, these Khazi assassins present a serious problem for me. The best way to kill them is to get Calamity on them. The best way to get Calamity on them is if one of them is knocked down.
Right.
A good example, real quick, where, like, Keith's done this to me, is, like, attrition's going south. SR 2014 is an amazing, like, sort of thing to base these goals on. So if you can just squeak out, like, a little foreign zone around a scenario and get a cheap point early, it allows you to get a cheap 2 points late and win, you know, maybe close out a game. And so if you know if a game is going to go south for you, it's like Keith's, like, you know, had Hetty, like, slam one of my models out of the zone early that was really inconsequential at the time because I was just cleaning up models. And then late game, maybe pops Gatsby's feet and, like, finishes it off with a quick 2 points. It's like, oh, geez, son of a, you know, if I hadn't given up that 1 point, it was an unwinnable game. But it's a winnable game for him if he gets, you know, an early. So it's like, some SR 2014 is a great place to get those type of decisions.
I think
made.
In that particular game, it was an instance where I basically gave away Deathjack.
You gave away
score.
A Slayer. You actually didn't have Deathjack.
It was a Slayer.
It was just a Slayer.
Oh my god, that was such an old.
And I forgot Overrun.
You did forget.
Yeah.
Or forgot.
Sorry, Hypergressive.
Hypergressive.
But still, the point being that you made the decision, like, I so disrespected, like, you were thinking at, like, this really micro scale, and, like, I hadn't even considered it. I was like, I'll concede a scenario point because I'm having so much fun killing all your dudes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but it completely cost me.
I was
me,
like, well, he's killing all my dudes, but if I get this point now, I'll be able to get this point over here.
You had
probably
a
in a turn
strategy,
or two, and then...
Yeah. You knew exactly, like, this narrow window to win, and you executed it perfectly. Because even if I'd, like, run it with Beast 09 and Behemoth, I was so not responding to that plan. I had two jacks. He can't, like, feet and get both, especially with, like, a caster who's a high-defense caster. With a war dog, like, I could have made that an unwinnable scenario, but just getting that one scenario point gave you, like, that window to, you know. So it's like, sometimes you make those plans, you don't really think how, you know, if you focus on it early, how much that pays off at the end. But SR 2014 is a great spot to do it.
So another game, I think maybe just anecdotally talking about examples will kind of show some of the thought process.
Mm-hmm.
So my game against Brian White at TempleCon, great game, right? My entire plan that game was to...
Do you like how he does that? He's like, this game I played, great game, right? It's a great game.
Yeah, I bring up an example where I lost.
Yeah.
I shall give unto you some props.
He's like,
I shall give unto me some props.
By the way, I played this game against one of the guys that's on Dream Team USA to go to the WTC.
I
won that game. It was a great game, right?
That was an amazing game.
I'm listening.
It was an amazing game from both sides. I guess I earned this.
I'm listening,
game.
John.
I was listening. It was a good one to watch.
And I respect you.
Me and Tom Gwan enjoyed it.
Yeah, right?
Who?
And then,
you and who?
Tom Gwan.
Who?
Yeah, anyway. But some of the goals that I set in that game, like, I knew how I was going to win that game, which was on scenario. And I knew that I was going to... score 3 in one turn.
I want to make a point about that, so remind me of that when you're done telling your story.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I was going to put Sorsha on one. Like, he wouldn't be able to contest both flags, and I'd be able to dominate for 2 with Sorsha. That was my plan. So I played the entire game, saving my feet for the turn where I could score three, and also maneuvered my army such every turn, moving me towards scoring the turn I could feet. So, like, that was my – I guess that's kind of a big goal, but every turn I worked towards that big goal of the 3 points in one turn and saving my feet for that turn, because it really reduces the reprisal, and then I can come in and dominate for two because of Source's mobility on either flag.
I'd actually say that's a different strategy, because in the first example, you identified one specific event that could not happen.
Yep.
If you were to win, and you didn't have an exact goal for how you were going to win.
Yeah.
And I mean, however that game played out was however that game played out, but that's what you identified. And in the second one, it was you identified how you were going to win, and you didn't know exactly how that was going to happen on a turn-to-turn basis, and you just sort of worked towards it. So it's almost two different ways of approaching the same problem of having a plan, of identifying... Yeah, this is impossible. It's just impossible.
So it's really hard. What I wanted to say, like, in this case, we can look at it as he's looking at it from a macro level in the second example,
mm-hmm.
And then he's looking at a micro level action in the first example. But a good way to think about this and look about this, I think, is there's an old, sort of definitive competitive magic article a while back Mike Flores wrote called Who's the Beatdown? And the idea was that if you misidentified in a magic game which one of you was the aggressor, if both of you thought you were the aggressor or both of you thought you were the control, whoever was actually right was always going to win that game.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can apply that somewhat in War Machine because there are, and we've talked about this before.
And if you're both right, it's a game?
You can't possibly both be right. It's just impossible for you to both be right. One of you is control, one of you is aggress. Like, always. That's the case.
And if one person says, I'm control and they're right, and the other person says, I'm aggressive, correct.
Then that's a game that you play, like, equally, yes. But that if you misidentify your role, it equals a game loss.
Yes.
Okay. So, in this case, we've talked about War Machine, and there's three ways to win in this game, right? Like, you can assassinate, you can attrition, or you can scenario. Okay? Frequently, attrition will lead to a victory by one of the other methods, but those are
a foregone conclusion. Victory in one of the other methods.
But those are your three ways to win. Often you'll build a list thinking that this list is going to be strong in this particular facet of the game, right? You don't build a Morton Ebra list to attrition down. My Gorton list, I'm definitely always thinking about scenario when I play it. So I think if you come into the game, you want to identify your role. And there are times, like, even if you build your list a certain way, it may not actually be the case that you're favored, right? There are times that, like, I have my Gorton list and out against somebody else, and I look at the scenario and I look at the pieces they have, and I'm like, I probably won't win this scenario. I'm going to have to...
Pause. This is Edenny. Like.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean... That would never happen.
Oh, balls, it's E. Haley?
That could happen. In which case, I'm like, well, my goal is to kill her Colossals, and if I kill her Colossals, then I win this game, right? Like, I've identified a different, like, I've got an attrition. Like, I'm not just going to win by scoring a point and then having Landslide back up to, like, score me two or three points on a single turn. So, you identify your role in the game. You decide, am I an attrition victor? Am I an assassination victor? And you got to identify that role correctly. And then once you identify that role correctly, you have to look at the pieces that you have and the pieces that they have and figure out what are the most, because it changes. There are games with my Gorton list in which I'm like, I've got to win this game on scenario. So my most important pieces in this game are actually Wrong Eye and Snapjaw and Gorton's feet. Like, Gorton has to be positioned in a place where he can use his feet effectively to score points. Wrong Eye and Snapjaw have to be positioned in a place where they either get me up some quick points or they contest points so I don't get down on them. But then other games will change. I'll be like, okay, this game I probably can't win on scenario because of the scenario and the matchup that I'm facing.
Because that's Tiberian.
Right. So the Earthbreaker is the most important piece in this game. And everything is centered around the Earthbreaker surviving because it will kill the opponent's army. And so, Like, you need to identify your role, and then once you've identified your role, you need to identify the pieces that are the most important to that role. And once you've identified that, then where to position them, how to position them, how to counter the pieces that are, like, the ones capable of taking out your important pieces. That's the game. Like, that's the game that you're looking to play.
That is why, and that's an excellent, excellent description of what we're talking about. That is why, as a peripheral, and this will help explain some of our other thinking, and we talk about casters, is why Epic Asphyxius, why Kane 2, why Haley 2 are all such monsters, is because they have every plan, at least in the B,
absolutely.
In the B plus
range, absolutely,
or better. And they're just like, so every game they get to decide, like, that person over there is weak to scenario, like, so that's what I'll do this game, I guess.
Right.
And it's because there are casters that are, like, locked in. Like, that's one of the reasons why I'm not a huge fan of Morten Ebra. It's like, she is an S-level assassination caster. That has been proven at this point.
Yeah.
But you run into an S-level defensive caster, and you're like, rut-row.
Like, rut-row, Borka.
And she maybe, yeah, like, that's pretty bad for her.
Unless that guy who I don't know is playing her, in which case it's probably fine for him. Whoever he is. But I don't know his name.
If there was some theoretical master assassin.
If there was some theoretical Asian Californian master assassin.
Petite.
Who's dead to you?
Who is dead to me.
Yeah, who backstabbed you?
Who backstabbed me cruelly and whose retribution will be swift.
Morten Ebra doesn't have a backup plan. Like, there is no plan B for her. And there might be, like, you're like, I guess I throw these in and hope my defense holds out. I guess I throw these in and hope the armor holds out.
The thing she plays plan A every turn.
Yeah.
Until she wins.
She does.
So,
I mean, she's committed to it. She's, like, you know what's coming, and every turn she's going to try and do that over and over and over again.
She's a chip in a chair caster, though.
She is.
Yeah. I mean, that's... To be that narrow a caster, to be focused on one plan and one plan only, and be viable, I think you have to be a chip in a chair caster, right? Like,
so yeah, that's why the casters I identify as the strongest are that's how I identify them, is their strength, their strength and versatility.
Yeah, because it allows you to be flexible in your plan, and I guess that's really what we're ultimately talking about. Is a lot of people go into, I'm not going to say a lot of people. Some people think that the game stops when you've developed your list and you have your overall plan, and this is my plan. And you see that a lot. Like, they're very mechanical with what they do.
Absolutely.
You know, and they do the same things. They do them very well.
It's actually something I was trying to coach Eric on the other day, because he had he was playing this Gunbjorn list that he's been dojoing. And so he had... Bushwhackers, that's their name, right? Bushwhackers.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So I had Bushwhackers, and he deployed them, and then his opponent was playing Scorn and deployed Bloodrunners opposite them, which Bloodrunners and Bushwhackers in the game, that was... Yeah. But that aside, like, obviously that's like a nightmare for the Bushwhackers, right? Like, they're just going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, you don't... And this was something Keith obviously taught me, which is just... The way that your army is set up is not the way that it has to unpack. This is not, like, you don't have to look at the Bushwhackers across the Bloodrunners and be like, well, we're fighting them even though we can't ever win. That's what we're going to do. We're going to fight them.
Like, hope they make a lot of tough checks.
They can run. Like, they can go somewhere else. You can redeploy your army. So, and even if what they do is nothing for two turns, at least then on turn three they're doing something, right? Whereas... Otherwise, they're just dying to Bloodrunners. So, I don't remember exactly what you started saying. I kind of think I got off track.
I was just talking about how...
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about playing a flexible game.
Right.
And how it's good to think about your list in a way like, what is my overall plan?
Right.
But that plan has to be super flexible in the game of War Machine.
Right. It's not just, like you were saying, it's not just, I set these up and then my army fights what's across from me kind of thing. Like,
flexible before... And during the game.
Correct. Like,
before the game, you can't be set into your plan.
That's true.
During the game, you can't be set into your plan.
I think that's actually a really, really good point. And if I could expound on Josh's point a little bit when he was talking about identifying which role is going to give you the best avenue to victory in the game that you're playing.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it changes.
It sometimes changes mid-game, you know.
Absolutely. Sometimes the odds that you have set up, the way that you see things playing out, they don't. Like, this is still a dice game. Sometimes things don't go the way you expect.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that we could define those as macro goals, overall overarching goals.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
And then micro goals are small things within each turn of the game that are important towards achieving that macro goal.
Absolutely.
And that there are a lot of, like, if you have a good, if you have the correct macro goal, then you can utilize micro goals that work towards that overarching goal towards a path to victory. So the game isn't as simple as positioning well or trading well or all the things that we've talked about in the past. You know, it's also executing your plan, but also the correct plan for the situation, and hey, you have to be dynamic with that plan. God, this is such a great game because there's no way to solve for War Machine.
No.
Right. There's no
You
there's
can't
no,
solve it.
Yeah. This is also like a really good way when you're breaking down a game at the end of the game, when you're thinking back on your game about
the right goal? If I had done something.
Absolutely.
And that is the hardest analysis to make post game, because you have to be able to imagine an entirely different game. You have to imagine everything being different. Like, what if everything was different? And the hardest thing to do when you're doing that is not to put on the rose tinted goggles.
Yep. Yeah.
Because sometimes when you lose, you did make the right choice.
Right. Yeah.
You just got beat.
Yeah. And sometimes I'm going to say this one time only. And if anyone ever brings it up to me in person, I'll probably slap them. Sometimes it is dice.
Yeah.
Once in a blue moon, sometimes you made the right choice and it's dice. Like, that happened, I think, to me in that game against Chad, where it was like, I don't think I made an error. I think I left myself with the mathematically best way to go.
I mean, other than letting him one-shot you, yeah.
No, you decided afterwards that you didn't.
That
you
I didn't
need to kill Snapjaw. You could have just camped on 7.
Yeah, I think that you did say that.
I thought about it, and then I thought it was a question of whether or not, because killing Snapjaw left me 2 paths open. It left me assassination or attrition, or rather, it left all 3, assassination, attrition,
sure,
and scenario, because it freed up that flag.
Yeah.
Not killing him closed off, I think it closed off scenario, and it might have closed off attrition.
Sure. Potentially.
So, I don't know. Anyway. But, yeah. Sometimes you make at least most of the right decisions, and your overarching plan was correct, and subsequent things went wrong. And then you need to make analyses of your micro decision-making.
That's what I was saying. Like,
I'd say that's most common.
It's not just sometimes I'm, like, there's a lot of times at the end of the game I'm like, no, like, I've definitely picked, and particularly as somebody who's not as experienced with the game as you guys, like, I'm still, like, I like we just talked about, like, this, like, learning cliff, I'm just, like, now, like, I'm like, I know what everything does, this is cool, so, like, now I'm getting to the point where it's, like, I can go back and I can look at the game, and I'm like, yes, like, going for an attrition game plan here was, like, the correct choice, that was the right thing to do, but I did not place, like, high enough importance on, for example, keeping Ragman alive. And had I just realized how important Ragman would be, like, later in the game, like, I could have done some other things to make sure that it was a lot harder to kill him and given me a better advantage to, like, win, say, this Colossal on Colossal matchup that inevitably was going to come. Like, things like that. So, like, and those were, like, how we first got into the game, as you talk about, like, the small... micro level, like, level of play, and when you're evaluating your game, that's, like, that's the area where you can frequently be like, and where I feel like I sometimes gain the most growth is going back and looking at the game and be like, yes, I knew, like, from the outset that this was the way I wanted to play this game, and I was right about that, because had, like, this thing and this thing and this thing gone differently, I would have won this game. So how would this and this and this have gone differently if this piece had been alive, if this piece had been in a different position?
What we're saying is to identify your whether or not your macro choice was correct if you lose. Because, of course, you don't go into the same in-depth analysis of a win as you do a loss.
Right.
You're like, I lost this game. How, like, this and this and this went wrong, like, on a micro level. Like, this Jack got killed by that unit of infantry.
Yeah, I left it in threat range.
And cascaded into, like, this whole flank collapsing, and then everything died. Because I was trying to fight, like, we were fighting for attrition, and this is where you're like, well, and you reanalyze the math, and you're like, that Jack maybe shouldn't have died. Like, if I had put a couple pieces out to protect it, maybe it would have lived. And you're like, but if that Jack lives, do I then push through? Do I win that flank? You have to be able to honestly answer those questions without the bias of my stuff is great and my opponent is bad, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, you can never get ahead if you, like, be 100% honest with yourself.
Be brutally honest with yourself. So then, and if your answer is no, then you back up to the last place where you made where something happened or you made a significant decision. Like, well, at this point, if I'd saved these two pieces that could have supported that flank, then yes, I would have pushed through. So I still think attrition was the right play. I just needed to be more conservative or more aggressive in these ways. But if you go back and at every turn where a small thing went wrong, the outcome would have been, if you can determine that the outcome would have been the same, like, yeah, no matter what, like, this flank collapses horrifically to that monster that was coming at me. Like, these dark guidance, scar-feated Bane Knights kill whatever. So, no matter what I do over here, like, this is going to go badly. So, wasn't the right plan.
I might have a problem with rose-tinted glasses because I'm a very positive person. But I've never thought about a game I lost and not thought about a lot of small things and sometimes very major things that I couldn't have done to potentially change the outcome. And I'm not always convinced that it would have, but I find so many mistakes in my play when I go back through games.
Yeah, and at some point there, you're like, oh, I didn't put enough pieces to contest this zone.
Yeah, or I put too many.
And if you had, it would have left you avenues to, like, oh, and then maybe next turn I could have sneaked in the scenario point and then gone the scenario route instead of, like, the end result was you trying to just kill the things that were there because you got overrun.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it might be that, and because you didn't commit to the scenario, there is definitely a point of the game where you can identify that you've abandoned scenario, you've abandoned assassination, or you've committed to either of those things and that resulted in failure, and it was actually the decision to go that route, that result, that was the cause of failure, not your execution of the plan. And identifying that is much harder than looking at those small mistakes. So it's a question of being able to say, do the small things add up to a win if they're corrected, or do the small things still... Are the small things not enough? Did there need to be a larger shift?
Yeah, did I need to have a better macro plan? It's interesting, too, because your macro plan isn't only determined by your opponent and what they're playing and what you're playing and what the scenario is. Sometimes there's external factors. Like, for example, I knew at Mayhem Cup that I was going to need tie breaks to get into the top 16.
Oh, sure.
I literally played my last round for scenario, no matter what. I played the entire game to score 5 scenario points.
Sure.
Yeah. And that makes it harder.
It does.
You're like, can certainly kill the caster this turn.
Yeah, but at the same time, you can't tell your opponent that that's your plan. You can't telegraph it because it makes it easier for them to play, too.
Yeah. And actually, it's not as bad as it sounds, because limiting yourself to scenario play isn't cutting off all avenues of victory. It only is cutting off the one.
Yeah.
It only cuts off assassination, because you can attrition and just refuse to kill their caster no matter where they put them,
mm-hmm,
and go and scenario your way out. So, anyway. I don't know if we solved that. I don't know if we beat it to death, but we chewed on it.
I don't think that there's a way to solve that. I just think it's an interesting way to think about the game and to break it down into macro and micro goals. I think that was good terminology, Josh. So,
yeah.
Kudos.
Thanks. See how little the old Mike Flores coming back from the grave. He's probably not dead, but...
He's still around. I remember that article very well.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of, like, the seminal articles in terms of Magic, like it definitely is reference. I mean, some of that's Mike Flores hyping himself, but it was...
Oh, you mean like I do?
Yeah, a little bit. It was huge. Like, the whole, like, who's the beatdown reference by tons of people, definitely, like, a key category of thinking about the game, and I definitely think it applies to War Machine, so... Yeah. Yeah.
Very good.
So I know we're probably, like, longish on time, but it'd be nice.
We're not too bad. Let's do this list buster.
Well, I was gonna say that'd be nice to do the list buster since we haven't done it in a while, and I got this game in this week. So, hey, Merc players, remember that I will always do your list busters. These other guys, you know, they suck, but I love you. So remember, I love you.
I'm sure I did more list busters than any of you. Just want to.
Oh, but I did want to ask.
I'm sure I did.
John, I did want to ask you a question before we did the list busters.
God damn it!
Awesome.
What?
Can we get a Nigel pirate joke after this one?
If he's got one,
sure. I can make one up here.
All right,
carry on.
So, John, what is Captain Hook's favorite kind of store? The secondhand shop. Yarr!
What is going
on? Someone needs to get him a mic when Josh starts telling everything. People might accuse us of having a laugh track.
I was going to say, we just need a canned track of Colin laughter to splice in after every pirate joke.
All right, Nigel, you're up.
No.
Oh, God.
He's got performance issues.
Yeah, hold up.
No, it's fine. That's totally normal.
Yeah, Lance will save it. Don't worry.
Somebody at your age, it's exactly. Acceptable.
It happens.
Yeah.
John Damaris.
I love it already.
How was Brad Wesley's favorite henchman killed in the movie Roadhouse?
How?
A throat rip.
Nigel sells it way better than you do.
I'm trying to tell legitimate pirate jokes, okay? Here's our...
But he's also pandering to Colin. Totally. He's like,
see, Colin laughs less than when I tell the pirate joke.
He likes the actual pirate joke.
He loves the actual pirate joke.
I thought he'd buy into the throat rip bit, but never mind. What do you mean worked a little hard? I had to make that up on the fly.
All right. Enough off mic chat.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Come on, Colin. Go. This is a professional podcast.
Yeah, hand me those M&Ms.
All right.
So I recently played a list that I've been getting some questions about for a while, basically since shortly after Gaston was spoiled. I've had some people ask me about this. Going into this game, I did not think this list was viable. After playing the game, there's probably a little bit more to it than I initially gave it credit. So I'm glad I played this game.
Anyway, Fiona the Black?
What's that?
Was it Fiona the Black?
No. It's a Durgan list. So it is... The list I actually played is on page... whatever, it's the next to last one. I think it's page 7. Let me double check real quick. Yeah, page 6. Page 6 of the... list busters, which is currently on page 3, but hopefully that comes back up to the top now that you guys know that I will continue to do list busters regardless of what these guys do. Was posted by Makina, I believe is the name, and it is, Makina. And the list is Durgan Madhammer with an Earthbreaker, Ralik Morklaw, which we can talk about, Goblin Tinkerer, Ayana and Holt, Tactical Arcanist Corps, Gaston with a Galleon, Dougal, Reinholdt, and Thor. So obviously very small list. It's the old double colossal list. This seriously was when Gaston came out and people realized that he could take a Galleon. Everyone was just like, Durgan, Earthbreaker, Gaston, Galleon. Like, I've received a couple questions about this and, like, yeah. So, my initial opinion of the list is no. Like, I don't like putting 18 points on Gaston who can be hunted and killed with, like, if your opponent's dedicated to it. Like, the amount of effort that they put into killing Gaston... It probably takes more than 3 points to kill him, but it definitely doesn't take more than 21 points to kill him, right?
Probably.
So, yeah. So, the Tactical Arcanist Corps definitely helped, but that'll be something I discuss a little bit about the list after I talk about the game. I ended up playing against one of our local gamers, a newer gamer guy. He's playing Kador. He's playing Pete Irisk. He had a... unit of Widowmakers, unit of IFP, unit of Kiazi, I'm forgetting something. Great Bears were in the list as well. And obviously, Iris and Battlelust can kill an arm 20 Colossal, which is, I have no arm buffing, so that's the highest I get. So I was slightly concerned about the matchup. The Widowmakers and Widowmaker solo were also concerning based on the fact that this list is...
My favorite Cauterer models.
Yeah. The best, worst four-point unit in the game.
Yeah. So amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, they were certainly concerning given that this list... I mean, this list is, like, all about, right? Like, it's about Gaston, Thor, and Dougal surviving. Like, those are...
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if those models don't live, you're in trouble. Obviously, this list has, like, a strong assassination game. Like, Durgan in and of himself has a good assassination game. You add, like, the Earthbreaker's guns and Galleon's guns to it. It's going to be hard for a caster to hide from that, particularly with both Many Feet and Dougal's Many Feet and Fire Group from Gaston, like, added onto the range. So, that was something I wanted to think about during the game, but I wanted to kind of, as I was playing it, I wanted to sort of focus a little bit on attrition, see if the list could hold up both on, like, scenario and attrition as I was playing, and wasn't just sort of like a one-trick, like, get our Colossals into range of your caster and then try and shoot you to death kind of thing. So, I did have a place where I could hide Gaston behind an obstruction, and base the Galleon next to it while contesting a flag in this game. That was definitely super helpful in keeping him alive. It also didn't hurt that Durgan did his usual turn one nonsense, walked forward with the rerolls deviated 5-1 on his carpet bomb and killed all four Widowmakers on the bottom of one. So, or on top, like top of bottom of one, I think. Whatever, anyway. They were all like on like a hill outside their advanced deployment, and he just killed them with Buster. So that's kind of what he does. But
okay.
I mean,
hey,
yeah.
Far be it for me to argue, because I definitely have adjudicated my way.
Yeah, like
it's people's not advanced deployment.
I certainly don't expect to kill all four, but like Durgan, I mean, that is what Durgan does. Like that's one of the reasons that he's as strong a caster as he is. He does. It's not quite Kane level work, but it's close.
Did you give credit where credit was due for that play?
That was 100% on. It wasn't you, right? Who was it that told me, like, just take the shot?
Crump.
Was it Crump? Okay, yeah, Crump. I was going to run Durgan to get him a little further up the field, and Crump's like, nah, just walk him, take that shot. And I was like, I have to roll, like, 1-6, and then I have to roll, like, good deviations off my bounces. He's like, you got Artillerist, so. I did, and I did.
It was a very generous amount of eye rolling, as I remember. You were like, okay, fine.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
This.
Yeah.
Like, and it was just like, oh.
Oh, well, we got it. Oh,
okay.
Like, because initially it was like 5-2, and I was like, oh, I'll keep the 5. I'll roll for the 1, because that's pretty, and then got the 1.
So Crump demonstrates again why he's
yeah, absolutely. He's the best. He is statistically the best mercenary player in the country. Like, I have to eat that.
Oh, the
for
gift
a while.
That keeps on giving. That is just the best
it's
thing
nice
ever.
It's nice that he takes time out of his schedule to coach you, though.
To coach me. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Give you, like, super wisdom. Like, you miss every attack you don't make.
I wish he had, honestly. I wish he
Nigel
had.
Nigel Wisdom.
So yeah, anyway, like, killing the Widowmakers early was huge. It took a lot of pressure off my solos, because that was something I was concerned. He had Epic Alexei as well, who was riding down the flank. There was actually a point in the game where that was relevant, because I felt like she was going to come in and kill Gaston, so I ended up going for an assassination later in the game, but... P-Risk was probably a little bit of a difficult matchup for this list. I mean, I am on record as saying P-Risk is the best Kador caster in the game, but...
he's really good.
Like, particularly against this list, he's just like, my army is all, like, 4-up tough and doesn't get knocked down on the turn that you're going to pour a bunch of shots into them, and then literally any of them can vaporize your Colossal by touching it, thanks to Battlelust. So, good game, I guess. But, Cloud Dwarves in this list, exceptionally important. Like I said, this list is all about keeping some certain key solos alive. You can put out a decent amount of firepower, but they're all super high-value attacks. There was There was a turn where I was attempting to just thin out his ranks of IFP, and he had Outriders in his list too, Greylord Outriders. I was trying to thin out his ranks of IFP and kill the Great Bears, because the Great Bears were capable of threatening the Earthbreaker, who'd moved up to contest one of the flags. So the Earthbreaker focused on killing the Great Bears, killed two of the three, leaving the other one on one box, and managed to kill the Relentless Charge one while leaving them in rough terrain. So that was good. But then Galleon and Dougal focused on the IFP, trying to thin them out, and I got some pretty mediocre deviation rolls, killing quite a fair number less IFP than I had expected. And that's one problem that this list is going to face when you're trying to do anything other than Assassination Down, is because you effectively have three models in this list that do work. That's it. It's Durgan, the Galleon, and the Earthbreaker. And that's such a low volume of attacks and such a high, like, high value on them that every deviation roll that doesn't go your way, every, like, low, like, statistically below average roll that you make in this list, like, it compounds itself, because it's vitally important that you kill a certain weight of models each turn. And so that is a significant drawback to a list like this. You'll feel it less when you're facing against a similar type of army. You know, like, if you're playing Legion, you would feel it less than if you're playing against, say, Krix or Kador. With infantry spam, but that is a weakness of a list like this. The other weakness of a list like this is the requirement to effectively, I mean, you effectively are just like, in most scenarios, Galleon is going to the close zone and the Earthbreaker is going to the far zone, and your opponent knows that and can set up in a way such that they can counter that to the best of their ability. So that's iffy. The final thing that I will say as a significant weakness about this list is that the Cloud Dwarves are, I mean, there are lists I really like Cloud Dwarves in, right? Like, I love them in Kador, where Valachev can attach to them and they can end up behind their clouds. I love them with, like, Damiano or Ashlyn. Ashlyn can quicken them, making them effectively defense 15, armor 16, five boxes in their clouds.
Surefoot.
Yeah, and Surefoot does a very similar sort of thing. And when you do that, much harder to kill. But when they're 11 to 13 in the clouds versus shooting 16, five boxes, significantly easier to kill. And every Cloud Dwarf you lose in this list is a big, big deal. Because as soon as your opponent can start, like, angling out and focusing on Gaston or Thor or Dougal, you're in trouble. Which is a situation I kind of got into. Guy was able to sort of focus fire. He's kind of sacrificed most of his Outriders to ride up and put a bunch of sprays on the Dwarves. And over the course, like, reduced me to one Dwarf, and then that Dwarf broke. So on the next turn, I was going to be without any cloud cover whatsoever. So Gaston was just going to be like, hope the Galleon can hide me. Durgan was going to be like, well, I hope I camp, or whatever the case may be. And the game was not necessarily over by any means, but he had, like, a significant weight of numbers. I was maybe going to be able to score on the far flag with the Earthbreaker, but it was going to take me, like, a little bit of time and effort. So inevitably what happened was it was a killbox scenario, and Irisk was on the wrong side of the table. So I chose to go for Assassination, which this list is certainly very capable of doing, very well situated to do. Probably one of the strong points of this list. Pop Feet, Durgan put a couple shots into Irisk, and then the Earthbreaker finished him off by knocking him down and putting more shots into him, tuned up shots into him. So, and then I still had Galleon available to walk up and put some long range shots as well. So it's something that your opponent has to be aware of. My opponent, obviously, a newer player. But he's a newer player, and because of the way he played in regard to my Forge Guard, and because the way some of my rolls went on my higher value attacks, I felt sort of compelled to go for the Assassination, which says something about the relative strength of the list, I feel. That said, I definitely had, like, some good turns in there. The Assassination is very strong. The list is probably more playable than I give it credit for.
It ties into what we were talking about before, where like the strength of a caster or the strength of a list can be identified in how well it can pursue multiple avenues of victory. And for this particular list, I feel like it's nearly dead in scenario.
Probably.
And oftentimes pretty dead in attrition.
Probably.
So you've basically got an assassination list, and it's how well, like, where does it rate among assassination lists? Eh?
Yeah.
So playable, perhaps.
Yeah.
But it definitely falls short of something that I would be
I'm not sure it's as bad in attrition as you think it is, because it has sort of an interesting dynamic in that it really just has to deal with the things that deal with two colossals. So...
Yeah.
Well, the problem is you can go from being live in attrition to being dead in attrition very quickly, and sometimes without outside of your control. Like,
if they kill a colossal,
a spray through the colossal went better than expected, and it
killed Castle. But
yeah, I was gonna say one of those colossals is basically like 14-15 with 5 HP, right?
Yep.
I do have a question about that though.
14, by the way.
You can reactivate it with your caster, right?
No.
Nope, not in this army.
You can reactivate it with...
Human
war caster.
The Tinker. You can reactivate it with Ralloc.
Ralloc can reactivate it in this game.
That's it.
Nope.
So,
which may be the reason he's in it.
Probably.
I don't know. Like, when I looked at this list, I was like, I feel like Ragman just a better choice than Ralloc. Because you already have the Tinker, you have Thor, you have Repair, like,
so,
running around.
You know what that list made me think of?
Hmm.
And I'm going to give this guy credit because it just literally made me think of this. This list just popped into my head, but it's a Protectorate list. But I was like, actually, two Judicators with Peace Heavy with Tristan running one. So one has got Defender's Ward and the other one has Fortify. Seems pretty strong.
I mean, I like that better because of the armor skew. Like, that's part of the reason that I... Like, this... This has two of the best offensive Colossals in the game, without question, which is nice. But Galleon is not that hard to kill when it is not somehow protected, and there's no way to protect it here. Like, literally no way to protect it. And the Oathbreaker's fine. It's like killing a Conquest, which is not easy, but not impossible, you know? So if they just have to dedicate... And that, like Keith was saying, like if one of the Colossals die, they just have to kill one. If one of the Colossals dies, your scenario game is over. It's over. And if the Cloud Dwarves die, your solo support is in big trouble. Like, that's why I initially thought this list was probably unplayable. And it turns out it's not unplayable. But it's got some really glaring weaknesses. Like, I get it. Like, it's fun. It's certainly fun to pop Durgan's feet and have both, like, your Colossals go off on it. But, it's a nearly guaranteed assassination if they walk their caster into range. Like, it just is, because of his feet. But, I'm not sure that's good enough.
Doesn't sound like you're too excited.
I'm not. Like, it was a fun list to play, and it reminded me, like, I probably don't play Durgan enough, as much flack as I get on the Mercenary forums for what my opinion of Durgan is. Like, he is... I understand why everyone champions him. He's super fun. He is. He kills a bunch of stuff himself. His feat's cool. He's live in a lot of different situations.
He's got a good spell list.
He's got a good spell list. Though, this list... That's another knock against this list, is that it makes poor use of his spell list. Like, all you're really doing is redlining a Colossal and then shooting his gun every turn, which is still good, and, like, holding his feet for, like, to scare your opponent on assassination. It's still good, but you're not making use of Primed, which is probably the best, like, offensive buff in the game.
He's got Inhospitable Ground, right?
He does have Inhospitable Ground. Which is good. Yeah. Less good against an army that has, like, all relentless charge all day. But, yeah, it is good.
Well, we've talked about it before. It's a situational spell.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sounds like an interesting a list to talk about.
I may give it another game or two just to play around with it. Like, it's definitely... So, it's a list that's good enough that, like, if you have, like, a league night or, like, a local, like, tournament or whatever you want to play, like, this list can... play in that, but I wouldn't take it to a con. Like, I just think it has too many glaring weaknesses, and I'm not sure that there's really anything you can do. because there's not enough points to put, like, Wrong Eye Snap John, a Bull Snapper in there to, like, buff up the armor. And there's no way that I can think of to make the Cloud Dwarves more survivable other than maybe put, like, I guess you could try and find 4 points to put a Vanguard on Gaston as well to give yourself a shield guard to increase survivability a little bit. But it's not, like, the end of, like, that might help. Ralik's unnecessary, so that's 2. So you just have to find, like, 2 other points somewhere.
I'm not sure he is as a backup plan. It's not the worst thing.
I mean,
ever.
You might be right.
An autonomous galleon is certainly much, much better than an inert one.
I don't disagree with that statement. It's just an issue of whether or not when you make this list, if you're just sort of committed to Gaston must live as long as the galleon does.
Otherwise, you have to include Sam, Meg, Ralik. What's his name? Ritgar Shaw.
Right. Yeah, I think that's about it.
Does Ralik repair?
Ralik repairs.
Okay, that makes him a better choice probably than Ritgar Shaw.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he repaired my Earthbreaker after it took redline damage in this game. That's what he did.
But so he was following around the wrong Colossal.
He was apparently following around the wrong Colossal.
I think it, in the design phase, it was probably Tinker follows yeah, Earthbreaker, Ralik
right.
follows
you're probably
Galleon.
Right. I figured Ralik, my Earthbreaker was committed to the far zone, so I figured Ralik more survivable than the Tinker, mm-hmm. which is why they were set up that way, but I had not considered the reactivating thing, which is probably the reason Ralik was put in this list. So.
I can't think of a good other reason.
Right, because otherwise it's got to be like Ragman or something like that in this list, but yeah. Fun, this is not the list that changes mercs, like this is, I don't expect to see this list like doing well on competitive scenes, but it's playable. That's my take, anyway.
Cool. Well, continue to submit your list busters. I'm going to start doing some of the conversions list busters, I think, out of there.
Whoa.
It's going to happen.
All right.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Expect that by 2015.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. There will be at least 3 new sub-factions out by the time he starts to play Convergence of Xeris.
Also, I'm going to guess that right after this episode drops, you should go to the Muzon store because the Kauter faction tokens will be there. And they are amazing.
Yeah, I'm very excited about upcoming faction tokens. Seeing Nigel's designs, very mm-hmm. exciting.
I mean, he's obviously going to put more effort into Kador than any of the other factions.
Yeah, that's Kador, and then everything else goes downhill.
All right, so looking forward to declining quality.
Yep. Crix, I'm just using, since GW probably won't sue me, I'm just going to use Necron heads for all the tokens.
I figured eventually it's literally just going to be cut out wooden penises with words.
Yeah, exactly. Like wooden penises with like Necron heads in the end. Exactly, obviously. Oh, that's a cease and desist I'll never get. Yeah.
Check out the Muse store for the faction tokens there. They are very beautiful and will... I think be pretty effective for what they do.
No, they're great. And then I think we'll probably have Signar out soon.
Signar's next, then Mercs. And then after that, we will just bust in everything.
Sweet.
I think Nigel said he's going to have them all done in the next 2 weeks, right?
That was the theory.
Yeah. Keep an eye on the Muzon Mini store. Keep an eye
on the obituary, see if Nigel commits suicide.
Yeah.
Follow us Twitter.
Facebook.
Yep.
Post
on
Facebook.
Are we on
say,
LinkedIn? Do we have a LinkedIn
no,
profile?
No, we
don't think we do.
But before we talk about Facebook, I just want to say for the record, I do not want you to unlike Chain Attack.
Yeah, why have you been telling people to do
that? Because I want us to be ahead. Instead, I'd like you just to make fake accounts and like Muse. But you can, yeah.
Some people have been requesting Muse on Minis Miami to have their separate Facebook page so that they can unlike us and Chain Attack. And like Muse on Minis Miami.
That's legit.
Yeah. I mean, they could make a Facebook.
You're not a permanent Miami member, Nigel. You need to stop.
I feel like I am.
You're a permanent SVU member, Nigel. When
no,
we
it's
get
true.
SVU going.
SVU hasn't gotten off the ground yet. Right now, I just want to hang out with David Caruso on the beach.
Yeah, well,
it's
okay,
amazing
that's fair.
Out there.
Well, that will give you more fuel for SVU.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
sure.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. This is Keith.
Josh.
Chad.
John.
Nigel.
He can't even spell. He didn't even spell accidental right. It's
actually legit Asian.
We're preambling now. Come on.
You broke my heart. What? I posted on Tom Guan's Facebook. Tom Guan, I know it was you. You broke my heart. You broke my heart. And I just got a bunch of question marks and exclamation points.
Very Asian.
Yeah. To which I replied that I found out through Keith that I've been replaced for the Lock and Load team tournament. And he claims it's accidental. Like what? He tripped and fell on Keith's dick?
All right. So let's go over the TempoCon team tournament. Why would Tom Guan want to replace you in Chile?
I don't know. I know why he'd want to replace Chile. Oh, you and Chili are my TempoCon teammates. Yeah.
It's my I don't care about this con teammates.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Tom Guan apparently reached out. I don't know if Tom Guan reached out to Aaron or Aaron reached out to Tom Guan, but they got together somehow. And then I got a text message from Aaron, which I can't respond to because it's overseas. And my phone won't do that. Chad, we're pre-rambling. Get the microphone up.
What?
So that, and then I just got a text message from Aaron that was like, "Hey, do you want to play in the team tournament for Lock and Load?" And I was like, And then he called me and he's like, "Hey, I need an answer about this team tournament at Lock and Load." And I was like, "All right, I'll play."
So, I'm hurt. I didn't get asked to play on the team tournament with Tom Guan and Aaron. I feel like
they wanted to build an all Cricks team.
I can play Crix. You run your stuff forward, you win.
Tom doesn't play Crix. He plays Circle now.
Yeah.
I think he's going to play Crix for this.
No, like...
Yeah.
I have to find out if it's 35 or 50.
I already know it's 35. I already know everything you need to know about playing Crix. You cast Overrun.
Oh my god, it's 35 points. I'm like, 3 Crix is so OP at 35 points.
Can you not repeat casters?
I don't know. I don't think we're planning on it. Like... Aaron ran down the list of casters they were considering and doesn't overlap with my preferences at all.
So you're playing Denny.
Mm.
Aaron is playing Lich 2. I don't know what his second is. Tom Guan is playing Mortnebra and...
Scar.
So the only thing we don't know is what Aaron's other caster is. Gorshade 3.
Maybe.
It's too bad there's like only 5 good casters in Crix, and like they really falls off a cliff there after that.
They suffer so much. Did you see Trevi the Great's post?
Probably.
He was like, I think I created the most broken Crix list ever. Scavarus double Kraken.
Wait, what? No, I didn't see this post.
Yeah, I was like,
I don't get it.
Adorable.
I was like, wait, what? So I was not trying to be mean. I just asked, so what does this list do? It's a fair question, right? Uh-huh. He's like, no, I think it's just really good because it forces your opponent to deal with like a really tough armor skew. And I'm like, he does realize these are Krakens, right?
They're arm 19, right?
I think. They might be 18.
19? Yes, 19.
19.
He has an armor spell.
He does.
Is it +2 armor?
It is.
To one of them?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Arm 21.
Arm 21 is good.
Yeah. 48 boxes, something like that.
Yeah.
54.
Yeah. I mean, it's no Imperatus, but I guess it's like it's okay.
You get to the thing is, you have extra points you can sprinkle in stuff to taste.
It's about a unit of warders. Once you calculate in the damage overflow from killing, you know, each warder.
All right.
It's 8 hit points, but then you know you don't count in the damage overkill.
Right.
Warders can't be rust bombed.
Also that.
I find Rust Bomb significantly overrated.
Really?
It's just like, it rarely comes up for me that Rust Bomb is the right thing to do. It's just really rare.
I've gotten a lot of good Rust Bombs in my
day. Yeah, you also play Crix.
I believe he was Rust Bombing with Kane.
Yep.
That too.
That happens. Fair
enough. Rust Bomb with Kane. Legit.
Sure.
In order to get Boomhauer guns to take down a Stormwall, sometimes you got a Rust Bomb.
That's probably true.
Yeah, Harm plus Rust Bomb plus Death Field engaging their Colossal because they don't get the defense.
Like the sheer number of blinds I've thrown versus Rust Bomb, it's like it's not close. It's not close.
Oh, blind is amazing.
No, it's because blind is super OP, but Rust's still really good.
Like there's turns where I'm like, I could throw a Rust Bomb here. and then like work on like killing this, or I could go kill this thing and just blind that. So I blind it instead. Plus, he's more likely to survive after a blind than a rust, I feel like. Maybe that's just my situational bias.
Potentially. I've had a lot of situations where I like me some rust.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of situations where I love me some blind, too. Actually, blind tilts your opponent so bad, too. They really hate it. Yep. If you ever really want to have fun, is you play Gorman against Jake and just watch the contortions he goes through to kill that guy.
Yeah, I mean, Gorman's super fun against Legion. Super fun against Legion.
No, did you bring a bolt thrower? Oh, no.
Naga 2 now. Stupid Naga.
Pot.
Yep.
The pot is just like, I'm going to fire this auto-hitting missile against you. Move the pot forward.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the... I always have the most fun walking him like out from behind a building, like into range of a colossal. And somebody just being like, I didn't know he was back there. Yeah. Like,
true line of sight is one of my favorite things about War Machine, which is why I really hate it when you play with like all flat terrain.
Like, they have a purple Gorman in a field of purple cricks, and he just like scuttles off behind something.
You know what? I don't miss.
Hmm.
I don't miss you playing Connie B. and then having to try and find Anastasia amongst 60 trooper models that are all painted exactly the same.
You mean silver?
Yeah.
They were.
Yes, exactly. And then it happened every game, too. You'd be playing them, and he'd be the feet turn, you'd be killing things. You're like, kill that, kill that, kill that. Wait a minute, where's Anastasia? Oh, she's right here. Okay, I got to kill that to get out of the way. All right, now I'm going to shoot Anastasia. She's 1621 with stealth.
Good times.
Connie's
feet.
Connie's feet.
Yeah. By the time you get here, you're just like, this is not cool, Keith.
Just make her run away.
That does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Rage Owl.
Collins Rage Owl.
Yeah.
Oh, as an aside, have you guys played against Brian White when he's played as Crix?
Yes.
No.
On the fronts of his leader models, he paints a chevron, like how sergeants have them on there.
Yep.
So he paints like chevrons on his leader models from on the front and on the back, so that as the opponent, you always know where the leader is.
Yeah.
And as he always knows where it is, because there's a chevron right on the base. It's actually really, really cool. I was like, that is really neat.
Marshall does that when he paints models for me.
Yeah.
Only on the back.
Marshall Payne and Mike Chiazzi, and so Matthew McConaughey, the unit leader, has two marks on his side as opposed to just one for his arc, and then Wilford Brimley, the underboss, has three marks on both sides to indicate unit attachment and unit leader. But yeah,
I mean, it's just nice. Yeah. It was really awesome as being an opponent having just a visual cue.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm like, where's the leader? He's like, well, if you look for the chevron, and I'm like, oh my god, that's so cool.
I certainly appreciate it when my opponents like do some work to make it so it's like, okay, this is what I'm playing against these, as opposed to like Keith or Tom Guan, who are like, here are like
30 Bane Thralls that are all our Bane Knights are all Cade painted exactly the same. Yeah.
And they're like, have like for themselves, they have like some marks on the back of the base, which no one can see but themselves.
For the last like couple of months, like we've just been having a steadily growing pile of painted Doom Reavers on our shelf. I don't know.
Because Marshall was converted for Jordan to paint.
Yeah, for Jordan.
The Butcher Teeth Theme Force. What's that called?
I don't know.
Dragon's Teeth.
Why do people like that theme force?
Because they
is that
know.
The theme one? There's some dragon something
that's with all the IFP.
And then they run to a buzzsaw.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a BK tier list or whatever.
Because it stomps people that are unprepared, basically. Yeah. And I guess that they enjoy that. I don't know. Anyway.
But yeah.
He was telling us that... And it was pretty cool because the Doom Reaver units were differentiated by the color of their sword. You know, they're...
Yeah. The Orgoth glow.
Yeah.
It'd be like green sword souls and blue sword souls.
Orange and red. And I was like, oh, that's a really cool effect. And he was like, yeah, I had to fight to get to be able to actually like be allowed to do this. And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, he originally asked me to paint them all identically. I was like, that son of a bitch.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't even matter for Doom Reavers.
That sounds like a rainbow
they don't
party,
vengeance
too.
Or anything. I guess it's more command checks if they're all alive.
Yeah. And you intersperse them together, so it's like, you know, the first six models that run forward are six command checks, and everybody else is all mixed together like D-bags.
Nigel's such an expert on being a D-bag.
Yeah.
Nigel, are you aware of what a rainbow party is? Keith didn't know this earlier today.
A rainbow party?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. I
like, Fox Nest.
I know what a rainbow party is, and I wish I didn't because I have a teenage daughter.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna take a dump, and then we'll get this thing rolling.
Okay. All right. That was literal.
Yeah, apparently he's...
goodbye, Keith.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, wow. He's going in the public restroom, though, for the dump.
You call
he's
him
actually...
He risks
he's
it.
Actually
he
dumping
there.
Right now yeah. as we speak.
No, he had to come back for toilet paper. Good for him.
We have hit him low.
Wait, why are
gentlemen?
Why are we calling it taking a dump? I thought we were calling it flushing an argument. Or am I the only one that does
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you're the only one.
Yeah. And to this day, I've not said that word.
That's not
good.
True.
That's
true.
Good.
I said it a bunch.
Yeah.
I believe you probably
Chad
have.
Brings it up all the time. And I'm like, Chad, we're not allowed to talk about
it. I always try
that.
And poke him with it. Like,
Oh, my God.
Poke the bear.
I was literally making the tokens for it just an hour ago. I should make it a turd. Just, they all get two turds.
Speaking of tokens,
just a little lie.
Holy crap! Did you redo those Signar ones?
Not totally yet. I redid the. So what I ended up doing for the shape thing is I did the trench knives with the bullets. I just made them boxes, so they look like ammo boxes or something. And then I gave them a little bit of like a. Weird, like, wood texture thing. So they'll look like crates or something.
Oh, cool.
So those are boxes, and then everything else is the circles. And then I got to make, for the two coils, I'm going to make, like, an arc of lightning down the middle. That's where the word goes through.
Oh, yeah.
So then the lightning will meet up at this arc of lightning in the middle, and then...
That's awesome. Legit.
That's what happens when I go take a disco.
These tokens are definitely sweet.
Yeah, so the factional tokens, like, we maybe could talk about this for a minute. Like, this will just be a nice Easter egg. All the factional tokens have a theme. So obviously the Kotor tokens have
you're
Russian
to go to the upstairs one.
Mm-hmm.
As a theme.
I'm just going to hear what you said.
But like I think Circle is going to be Celtic, right?
Yep.
And then Trollbloods is going to be
American Indian.
Yep.
Not Scottish.
Well, we didn't want to like get too close because I'm sure when I do Celtic, I'll cram Scottish crap in there too. Sort of have to like get all over the place.
Yeah,
with it.
Yeah. Sure.
So Legion will be Asian inspired.
That's racist.
Yep.
Why? Because they all carry katanas.
I just wanted to say that's racist.
Okay, whatever. And then, like, mercenaries will actually be inspired by the French, which I'm going to enjoy.
What? The French?
Yeah.
That's right.
Fleur-de-lis.
Yeah.
Oh, for, like, the Leilis.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
What about four-star?
I don't know. Actually, it'll be French and pirates. It'll be sort of the two.
Yeah.
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 Old Jolly Roger will be out there.
Yar,
har, fiddly dee. And then, what other factions?
Persian for
really
Scorn.
Yeah, the Scorn.
Minions will be gators, or, you know, like voodoo New Orleans crap. What else are we missing?
I don't know.
With Menoth, that one's a toughie.
It'll be like Catholic, I'm guessing.
Like Byzantine Empire, I don't know.
Yeah, Byzantine is probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
But I'm actually really excited because each of those factional sets will have a theme. And it'll be a very cohesive unit.
Yeah.
Or a stack of effects. I don't know if you've seen the picture of the Kotor tokens, but they are gorgeous.
Yeah, they're awesome.
I just, like, want to join the Communist Party looking at them. Like, right now.
You pretty much are a communist. What are you talking about?
I'm pretty much a communist. Yeah.
Hey, don't you live in a basement for free?
Yeah. I swing left, too.
And don't you work for free, what? Too? So, like, I'm pretty
exactly.
sure you got it all down. Although, to be fair, you get paid as much as I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. This is what I'm most excited about. I can't wait till people start seeing this stuff.
All right, John, behind you, there's a Route 66 glass up there by the paints. You don't have to turn your mic off for it. The table, people would love to hear the table. But I still need that shot glass, though. It doesn't change anything.
Can we start drinking
That's
on the podcast?
Point. Oh, my God, guys, hold up. I'm going to go up. I got on my way up from Houston. A special thing. So I'll go grab some.
Okay. No,
we can definitely drink. All right.
Thank you.
Job's done.
When I said, can we start drinking on the podcast, it wasn't really a request. It was going to happen if there was booze.
Yeah,
okay. And then I'm going to drive Keith home as fast as I can. I better pick out a pirate joke for tonight.
No pirate jokes.
No, they're
I feel like that bit's played out.
The fans have spoken, and they love it.
Nope, haven't seen a single request in weeks.
That was juicy.
You're a dump.
are you now playing the part of Colin? Is that what we're doing?
Great.
I took it to the bathroom, John.
You did. That's true.
You did.
We do appreciate that slight distinction. Usually Colin just pants.
So, it's actually really cute. Colin thinks that they're the premier podcast on the network now.
They do get more forum posts. So based on the metric of forum posts, based on the metric of people who have enough time in their daily life to get on the forums and make posts, you are the most popular podcast, Colin.
To be fair,
Josh, uh-huh.
Most of the people that post in our thread are new players, are new people.
Yeah. I also have noticed, by the way, that a lot of the posts about the popularity of episode one were driven by my beer segment. It's people asking me for beer questions. So really, it was your guest that drove the popularity of that.
We can have any particular beer segment.
This is sweet. I've never had this before.
This is actually my favorite beer of all time, but I just like the amber.
The amber is the one you like?
What's this?
I like the lawnmower, too.
What's the quality of the lawnmower?
This is probably a pilsner of some kind.
Yeah.
It's so a lawnmower beer is frequently something like a Hams or like a PBR or whatever. You mow your lawn and then you have your lawnmower beer.
Got it.
What do we got? An amber, a brown, and what's the
IPA?
I'll try the IPA.
Josh, you have a recommendation for me just based on what they are?
The brown, not the IPA.
Not the IPA.
The amber or the brown, probably. Amber might actually have more caramelly notes, but without having tried them, I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
The brown will probably end up taste. My guess is the brown will taste like a Newcastle or a Sam Smith nut brown. And the
like rolling rock or / water, the lawnmower is great.
Well, I do love water.
Nigel says if you like Rolling Rock and or water.
Trying to find...
You just got to man up a little bit.
Where the heck did the... where did the Listbusters thread go? I just used it the other day.
Saint Arnold.
So,
and by the way, you guys are welcome for me resurrecting Listbusters.
Thank you. We actually need to get back into that. If I ever play another game of War Machine, I'm pretty sure it's going to be a Listbuster.
I don't.
How come Colin
imagine
doesn't
that's
knock out 10 Listbuster games a week?
I don't know.
Why is that not happening?
No, I'm in the wrong forums. That's why I can't find
Colin.
It.
Colin
perfected.
He cannot go to Cedar Rapids without losing all his games.
Yeah. Speaking of which, how did that tournament go yesterday? Is that more on the? Is that a podcast topic, or are you saving it for two?
Yeah.
For Miami.
You
Keith,
know,
did you go to it?
It
100%
is. Went to yesterday?
So
no.
I'm so excited about this. Do you think the listeners can guess what I'm holding in my hand right now?
A piece of sheet with my DNA all over it.
Yep.
I would extremely doubt it.
Let it soak into your fingers. Those are pregnant fingers.
Gentlemen.
All right, you killed that bit.
Are you prepared for what happens next?
Sure. What's happening next?
Podcast.